testify today on House Bill 2554. This is a bill that received considerable attention in the House as we worked this bill through the House Civil Law Judiciary Committee. My involvement with this bill primarily arises because I have in my district the wonderful opportunity to have Northwest Medical Teams headquartered in my district. They approached me on this issue before the legislative session. With all the good work that you, I'm sure, are aware they do throughout the world in providing medical services to places where there is a dramatic need, they also have a program within the state of Oregon where they provide medical services. Maybe you have seen or are aware of the mobile health clinics and dental clinics they have that include kind of motorhomes that have been converted, which they take into low-income neighborhoods and areas throughout the state of Oregon. House Bill 2554, essentially, is designed to address a situation where a dentist or a doctor would be providing their services without compensation, and in return for that would be essentially protected from liability for any kind of a malpractice suit that would be brought. The way this is done is they essentially provide a form to the patient. There is informed consent on the part of the patient as to understanding the waiver of this right prior to the services being rendered. As I said, the bill was amended several times in committee as we worked out what I thought were legitimate and appropriate details in order to make this happen. Specifically with respect to Northwest Medical Teams, Mr. Chairman, the issue that we're trying to address here is they have these mobile dental clinics, but they sometimes have trouble getting doctors to volunteer their time. And the doctors and dentists that they primarily focus on are those that are retired but still licensed. In other words, they still carry their professional licensure, but they don't necessarily carry their own malpractice insurance because they're not practicing. These people are, of course, somewhat reticent to come forward and volunteer those services when, without that coverage, they may be putting at risk all their assets and the assets of their family that they've worked their lives to amass. So that was one of the main reasons that I brought forward legislation like this. This particular vehicle was a vehicle offered by Representative Mannix, which we modified extensively in committee to serve this purpose. I know that there are some dash A9 amendments prepared that have been prepared by, I believe, the Dental Association. They made some changes and also include hygienists along with dentists, and they make some changes from medical to health care, which I think are more to their liking, and I don't believe substantially impact the bill. I'd certainly support the dash A9 amendments when the time came, Mr. Chairman, for those to be adopted. I'd be happy to answer any questions any of the committee might have about this issue at your convenience.
Thank you. There was one change on the House side that altered the level of culpability necessary, and I believe it goes to a gross negligence standard where before it was intentional. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, originally I think we had drafted the protection to protect any health care provider anticipated under the bill, essentially doctors and dentists, from anything that was done in the situation unless except for intentional torts. In other words, if they intentionally harm someone in this process. There was some discussion in committee. The committee found it, I think, more prudent to adopt amendments which shifted that standard from intentional torts to gross negligence. So if there was gross negligence in the performance of this duty, House Bill 2554 would not protect them. Now, obviously, it's not as much protection, although the gross negligence standard is still a relatively high standard. I've just been informed, well, I wouldn't have any objection, frankly, because I think we're kind of straining at the gnats here, but I've been informed that the chairman of the House Civil Judiciary Committee has indicated an unwillingness to concur with this committee to make that amendment. So having just been informed of my chairman's position on that issue, it would be imprudent for me to suggest that this committee adopt that change.
And you're leaving to chair that committee shortly, so if you were opportune on when we sent this over, could that affect the passage?
I suspect it would not, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gordon.
I could be wrong on him, but that may have happened. And I was going to ask you about this. I remember I used to bill and give the 81 or 87. It's the same thing for doctors who, on a voluntary basis, would go to help put the athletic teams in the high school level and the college level and offer their services. So I introduced the vendor liability coverage for them to encourage, you know, that kind of volunteers in the athletic events. And I think I had to settle for gross negligence. I think that's where, I think that's in the law. I don't know if you know it is or not, but I think that's where that bill ended up. That's maybe why. I don't know whether it's tracked or not. As I recall, I ended up with gross, I still had to accept gross negligence if you're out here at Southdale and the Canary football game, you know, and or Western, they have an orthopedic. That person is okay, but I think gross negligence, they helped me. Because that may be what's tracking. I don't know, Mr. Chair, but I remember the bill way back before you even born. 1881, 18, my first couple of sessions.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, although I was born, I was actually attending high school in 1981, so I just say, on behalf of high schoolers everywhere, we appreciated your work on that legislation. Mr. Chairman, I think that the gross negligence standard is not an inappropriate one in this situation. It obviously is a fairly high standard to achieve, and I believe that the benefits that this bill provides, even the best standard, far and away outweigh not having the bill at all for organizations like Northwest Medical Teams. It is an interesting situation that the same doctors and if you adopt the amendment, dental hygienists and dentists that would be treated essentially under this bill to provide these services here locally, as we all struggle to find the resources to meet the need through our Oregon Health Plan and other programs, these same people who can't currently provide these services for fear of the litigation system are frequently stepping on airplanes and at their own expense flying to places in South America and in Mexico, in other parts of the world, and providing these exact same services to communities who stand in need, but yet we've created these barriers in their providing those services to folks here in the state of Oregon. The work that Northwest Medical Teams does both locally and internationally is a stellar achievement and a real sign of Oregon volunteerism. They're sending now, as I understand it, at least one team a week to the Kosovo region, made up of six medical professionals, including doctors and nurses, on a rotating basis. And it's really a tremendous, message about what it means to really volunteer in the state of Oregon. I'd like them to be able to have the same opportunity to use some of these same people locally for communities in our state where these services could be beneficial. So it's an important bill, Mr. Chairman, and one that certainly merits the approval of this committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You missed a great opportunity. In Health and Human Services, we had one similar but very different in a way. So the dentist could work with a tattoo artist and deaden the lips so they can redden the lips. Very interesting, this concept. I'll not worry anymore about it here.
Wow. And I'm glad we don't have that bill before. Other questions for Representative Williams? Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman.
At this time, I'd invite Warren Schaefer and Scott Gallen and Richard Ricks to come forward and testify, please. And I noticed some people with name tags in the audience. Lori, do you know who's sitting next to you? Okay. Well, welcome. Good afternoon. Scott, why don't you go first, and then we'll follow.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association. As the previous witness indicated, I've worked extensively on this bill and have agreed to the amendments on that side. This legislation is not unlike other states that have provided similar differences in liability levels for people who provide services without compensation. We think this essentially provides a reward for people doing good work and one that encourages physicians, dentists, and others, in fact, to participate under this sort of program. We would not object to the amendment proposed by the Dental Association. so that you would know that. I'm not sure that there is a real material difference in changing medical to health care, but I think it does make them more comfortable. We would not object to adding on hold. There's amendments for physician assistance to the list. But that's up to the committee. I'm hoping that we do not make very many substantive changes so this bill can, in fact, get through the process for the legislature adjourned. It was a very close vote on the House side, 57-0. I'm assuming that there had to be some Democrats who voted for it in the process. I'll end my testimony there.
Thank you. Before we open up the questions, we'll take our other guests, our other witness. Good afternoon.
I'm Dr. Warren Schaefer. I'd like to establish my credentials in saying that I've over 50 years practiced dentistry, the last 10 years of which has been primarily with Northwest Medical Teams. I sold my practice 5 years ago, and since then, I've spent a minimum of 8 days a month, sometimes 15, 16 days a month, with Northwest Medical Teams in the local mobile health unit, as well as have made several trips abroad. Our work, as the Congressman pointed out, we do serve a broad spectrum of communities. The recent immigrants, Russians, Hispanics, the farm laborers, the transit street people, the runaway juveniles, and many more. A normal day, I treat an average of 12 patients. The service I provide these people, if applied to minimum insurance allowances, would be a minimum of $1,000 a day, often exceeding $3,000. House Bill 2554 was drafted with good intentions, but I do not know of any volunteer that was consulted in its construction. The signing of the waiver, as I perceive it, and most of you folks are attorneys, so you may perceive it differently, but that the signing of the waiver would have limitations of validity. There are certain inalienable rights that cannot be signed away. You've changed the verbiage to now gross negligence, which is a step in the right direction, but informed consent is a real problem that I do not feel can be achieved in our environment. Very few of the people we treat speak any English. We are dependent entirely upon non-professional translators that do not accurately translate, and they do not have the capability of informing the patient adequately, in my opinion, of what they would be saying. Therefore, I question the validity of the waivers. You've added the mention of the dental hygienist, which is in my written testimony that I wanted to present, that they need to be added. Another thought that I would perceive in this bill, it is reasonable to expect in the volume of care we're providing there be some malpractice. I hate to admit that, but there is. And this makes no provision for any adjustment to a patient that has suffered. One of the biggest faults that I would find with the bill as it is written, it does not place a canopy requirement over the health care provider. It has no mention of them having to affiliate with a nonprofit organization, which I think is extremely important. As I read that, anytime I want to say I'm working nonprofit and I register with the Secretary of State as such, I'm in free. And I think that needs to be very important that these health care providers work under the canopy or an association or somehow with a recognized nonprofit organization. I told you the hours I work during clinical work. I'm also very much concerned with procurement, recruitment. Malpractice is a big issue, and I'm turned down more people than I can enumerate volunteering because there is not adequate malpractice. I will use the term insurance because I think that most of us in the work would prefer staying in insurance rather than in immunity. I think this is a significant difference. If there are people who feel they have a claim, they can still file suit, they can still sue us. Juries are very sympathetic to the underdog, adverse toward the professional, and I'm uncomfortable with this. I feel compelled to still buy my own liability insurance.
And you find it's at a reduced rate since the burden is the gross negligence versus ordinary negligence?
I cannot address that, sir. I wish I could. I would hope so.
It should.
But it doesn't. I don't know where I would get the answer to that. It should be. I would hope so. But I don't see it spelled out in any form. And it is a limited immunity. It reduces my liability, but does not eliminate it. I'm still uncomfortable. I will still buy my own insurance. I thank you for your time and hearing my testimony. If you have questions, I'd be happy to attempt to answer them.
Thank you for your volunteering and testifying. Senator Brown.
I had some discussions with Scott earlier, so I don't think you'd be too surprised about this. My concern is that aren't we really developing two sort of levels of care for the patients? And basically, I say that in contrasting it to lawyers. I mean, I would imagine there'd be a whole lot of lawyers out there doing a lot more pro bono cases if we didn't have to worry about the liability aspects for the client. And are we really setting two standards of care here for people who need medical services immediately and can't afford to pay for them versus those who can't afford to pay for medical services in terms of what standard of care we're holding the doctors to, or the nurses, the dentists, et cetera? I mean, this bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I don't believe so. Physicians and others will, as they do today, regardless of whether a patient is paying patient or not, in my opinion, will provide the same level of care that they would otherwise. Quite often, physicians, when patients come into their offices, don't know whether that individual, in fact, has insurance coverage or doesn't. They treat them in the same manner as they would a patient who has coverage. So I don't believe this, in fact, has that impact.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
But the reality is if a patient has income and doesn't come under this bill, if the doctor's negligent, that patient has some type of way to remedy that injury against the doctor. That's not true under this bill, unless it's gross negligence.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, we tried to do a couple of things so that the patient would, in fact, be informed. One is that we required in the bill, line 16 through 19, that the patient be given informed consent. You have to, according to our counsel, you have to provide informed consent, obviously, because if you don't, you are creating an intentional tort. That's one. Two, the way we try to address the issue that was raised a little bit earlier about making sure that the individual gets appropriate informed consent is also on line 18, which says, will receive the informed consent of a person who has authority under the law to make their health care decisions for the patient. I believe that is critical that an individual realize that these services are being provided without compensation. And that they are giving appropriate informed consent. I just do not believe in philosophy that merely because we have set a different liability standard here to encourage providers to provide health care services will lower the standard of care. It, in fact, will encourage more providers to provide services that people may not otherwise receive.
Is the informed consent intended to include limitations regarding the liability issue?
Says that no, it does not.
Okay.
The necessary to provide that compensation that the health practitioner may be held liable for death, injury, or other loss only to the extent provided by.
So the informed consent isn't necessarily on the limited liability issue, and I don't know that we would want to go there.
But I read this here, but the statement would actually have to include that.
Okay.
In order to be.
And I think to have a valid consent, you'd want to include it. Otherwise, you're referencing a statute that no one has in front of them. You're hiding the ball a bit. So I would hope that they do this. And if the case were someone's primary language is Spanish,
mm-hmm.
that would also be expressed in writing in Spanish to make it as knowledgeable as possible. And the risk is if we don't provide some coverage, of course, there will not be the self-coverage option that the insurance industry has.
Section 7 refers to the statutes and licensing, but people that answer the doctor's concerns. You have to be a member or some sort of certified or
part. Right. It does answer part of the concern that you are, in fact, licensed and registered. His other concern was that you be also associated with some nonprofit organization.
Okay.
And the rest of this doesn't require that other than the professional regulatory board. But as a practical matter, most of the people that provide these services are nonprofits.
Yeah.
At least the ones I'm familiar with. Other questions? Thank you for your testimony. I'd invite Jeff Watson.
Members of the committee, this is Jeff Washington here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants. And very briefly, I'm passing out to you a dash 8 amendment, which would simply include us in this bill. And just as brief background, physician assistants, or otherwise known as PAs, are healthcare professionals who provide physician medical services under the supervision of a physician. The PA and physician work together as a team to provide care for patients in order to increase access to affordable health care.
Jeff, yours are the dash 8?
Yes. I got them to Ann this morning, also out as part of my testimony.
Okay, good, because we have the dash 9, but we don't have the 8 here. All right.
Another interesting little factoid about physician assistants is our traditionally were primarily created to serve in places where the population does not have a lot of access to medical services, particularly rural and other underserved areas. And in fact, about 50% of PAs in Oregon practice in communities with a population of less than 50,000. So with that, it's a good bill, and it would be made a little bit better if we could get kids in there.
Good. Thank you. Questions?
Thank
you, Chairman. Yes,
sir. Thank you. What has been the experience of the physician assistants in the liability area? Has it been a big problem within your profession?
Chair Bryant, Chair Burdick, I wouldn't characterize it as a big problem. Just for the committee's information, though, usually sometimes PAs have their own liability insurance, but the usual practice is to be covered under the physician's, the supervising physician's liability coverage. And so I don't think that this bill would change that. It would still be up to the supervising physician to decide to be concerned about those types of things and be sure that appropriate measures are taken.
Council has a question on your dash 8 concerning the registry versus license.
Where is that bill, Jeff, in the process?
It's pending going through the Senate floor.
Okay.
briefly.
Is that a health bill?
Yes, it's a health bill that's come out of the Health and Human Services Committee.
So this is to catch a conflict amendment, is that correct?
Yes. Very briefly, the Board of Medical Examiners has stated that what they do for us is licensure, and the piece of paper that we get from the Board of Medical Examiners says license on it. And our health bill that you're referring to merely clarifies that. And so that's what my little hand engrossed amendment was intended to conform that to.
And so that bill deletes any reference to registration then and replaces it with licensure?
Yes, that's its intent.
Mm-hmm.
That should be okay. All right, thank you very much. You're not yet, but we will be in just a moment here. Any other person wishing to testify on Health Bill 2554? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing, open the work session. And committee, the chair would move the dash A8 amendments with the interlineation of licensed or registered on line 3. Discussion? Objections ordered. Chair then would move the dash A9 amendments to House Bill 2554. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. Chair then would move House Bill 2554 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Ordered. Carry it. What? We'll give you another. Let's see how the work he does. Senator Duncan, we'll carry it. We're going to now open the public hearing on House 2474. Committee, this is the one that I believe we have. There are going to be some amendments, so we'll only do a public hearing on it today, because it'll take a day or two to do the amendments. And the sign-up sheet includes. This is the amendment one. The witnesses are wondering, what is the chair talking about? No, it's not this one. It's the one from the builder's report. I'll invite Dave Honeycutt and Pat Turnbridge. Committee, at 2, I have to step out for a while to meet with the majority leader in the governor's office, and Senator Courtney will be chairing, but I don't think we have bills with great controversy this afternoon, so I shall return. Dave.
Thank you, Chair Brian, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 2474. House Bill 2474 deals with a problem that's been plagued both us and other folks in the home building development industry. And it has to do with exact conditions imposed by a local government in exchange for some type of development permit. A recent case coming out of the Oregon Court of Appeals indicated that if an exaction, if a developer chose to accept an exaction and then go ahead and go forward with the development application, let's say the exaction was to make half street improvements and the developer went ahead and did that, then the developer would be a stop from coming back at some point in the future and challenging those exactions under the Dolan standards, the Dolan versus City of Tiger case out of the United States Supreme Court, Fifth Amendment takings claim. So in other words, if you're the developer and the city conditions approval of the permit application upon some type of payment of some type of fee or some type of standard or something of that nature, you face two choices. You can read the current state of the law in Oregon to require you to face two choices. You either go ahead and comply with the conditions so that you can continue forward with your project, at which point then you can never challenge those conditions, or alternatively, you challenge those conditions in an appeal to probably to Lubin, the Land Use Board of Appeals, and then on through the appellate process, at which point your project is essentially halted. For the larger developers, that may not be a problem. For small developers, that essentially puts you in the ultimate Hobson's choice. You either go out of business or you forego your constitutional rights, and 2474 solves that problem. It also solves a problem for the local government in as much as the current statute of limitations for a challenge to an exaction is 6 years. A developer can go ahead and comply with an exaction and then wait 5 years and 11 months, turn around and sue the local government and demand his or her the money back or compensation for the exaction that was made. Neither one of those processes we thought was fair. So 2474 knocks down the statute of limitations in exaction cases from 6 years to 180 days, basically from 6 years to 6 months. In exchange, we make it clear that we can go ahead and accept a condition, continue forward with our project, and then turn around and challenge that condition, provided we do it in a timely fashion. The bill was the result of a compromise. It seems like there was no opposition on the House side. We met with Mr. Chandler from the home builders, and myself met with the cities and counties, local government folks, and worked out the language. It's a good bill, and we'd urge passage. I did hear out in the hallway that there was some talk of some additional amendments. I was in here waiting to testify on another bill, so I haven't seen those, or I'm not familiar with that conversation. You might ask Mr. Chandler, who I believe is talking about that.
Okay.
I see we have some proposed Senate amendments to AIM Gross Health Bill 2474. They're certainly not on NILC, and I don't know. This is the first time I've seen them, so I don't know anything about.
I believe that I spoke to someone who talked to Mr. Chandler, and there's some technical changes in the bill, and that was what was requested, and that Mr. Chandler was in agreement with that. Is he out in the hallway?
I believe so.
All right. So what? If you're in agreement with those changes, what we'll do today is take a public hearing and then go into work session when those changes are ready. It should only be a day or two.
Sure.
We could probably schedule for Thursday. Plan on Thursday.
Great.
Questions for Ms. Honica? Thank you. Pat Turner, if you come forward also, Tim Circum and Darren Brundage.
Darren is on his way. I'm not sure he's going to make it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. I think Dave has well summed up our position in regards to this bill.
Could you identify yourself?
My name is Pat Turnage from here in Salem, Oregon. I've only become aware of some of the problems involved with the developers, Mr. Brundage in particular. In his particular case with a city that had given an indication of what the FDT charges would be, they went ahead with their program. The charges in his case would be around $250,000. And in addition to that, with the state, he was doing another $500,000 improvement on the street, which did not apply to the FDT charges. So at that point, he's about $775,000 in SDC charges. The city, they asked repeatedly from the city of Oregon City what those charges would be, and the indications were in the $250,000 range. They went ahead with their development program, and in order to make your final application, you have to do your building plans, you have to do all of that. The project is ready to go, ready to turn dirt, and the city recently said now it's approximately $2 million for FCC charges. And they said, frankly, in their hearing, we know you can't back out of this thing. You're going to have to pay it or else. And the gentlemen are rather frustrated. What do you do? That is a substantial amount of increase in FCC charges. They arrived at that by expanding their zone of traffic influence from 3 miles to 5.7 miles, of which the Oregon City was only one-fifth of that geographical territory. Basically, I saw it as an attempt on extortion, simply to try to cure some money woes within Oregon City. That's simply an example. At this point in time, I think the direction this bill is addressing some of those issues. I've proposed a few amendments to the bill to simply strengthen that bill in regards to the ability to pull these kinds of maneuvers. I believe in free enterprise. I believe in a level playing field. And if you know what the game is going in, you can make your own choice as to whether you want to do your development or not. But I don't believe in going in and doing your development and then at the last second having a county or city agency be able to hold you up and basically make you decide to either leave or do something else. I'd be happy to give these amendments to the chair or however you would prefer.
You would give those to Judy. She will distribute them.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Don't have to do it right here, but I would... obviously, my ears picked up when you mentioned the Oregon City area.
Yes.
Would you mind, before you leave today, sharing with me the names of the parties and so forth? I'd like to
be happy to do that.
Check into that. And I asked some of my people in my county to look into it for me.
I thought you might.
Yeah.
Chair Bryant, members of the committee, my name is Tim Circum. I'm an attorney with the Preston Gates and Ellis Law Firm in Portland, and I represent a number of local governments as well as developers in my practice of law. I wanted to present a municipal perspective on this bill on behalf of some of my municipal clients. I am city attorney for Hillsboro, Troutdale. I represent cities and counties and districts around the state as special counsel on various projects. And as of lately, I've been involved in a number of cases involving challenges of conditions of land use approval that are brought in circuit court after the land use action has completed, which is the subject of this bill. I'm in the process of settling a claim for this fraud against Clackamas County, and that involved about $12 million in dispute, and for which some of the allegations were that there were unconstitutional conditions. I recently defended the city of Sherwood in litigation that was filed in Washington County Circuit Court and then appealed a decision against the developer to the Court of Appeals. That decision is L.A. Development versus City of Sherwood, and I've attached a copy of it to my testimony, which I'll hand to the committee clerk shortly. That case provides some of the context for my testimony to you this afternoon about how this works in a practical sense, how this bill might affect litigation that's actually been filed or that's in the court system. In that case, the developer sought a planned unit development approval from the city of Sherwood. And the way that process works is that there are two approvals that are given by the city, one at the beginning that sets out the conditions and you're going to satisfy the conditions, and then one at the end that says you've satisfied these conditions, now you can go ahead and file your plat and sell the lot. The developer at that first step, the preliminary approval, there was some argument with the city about whether or not these conditions were proportional, constitutional. There was a dispute. And then the developer said, well, I have an idea. I'd like to propose a compromise series of conditions. And he did that. And they were the ones that were imposed by the council. The developer took no appeal from that decision. He made no objection to the conditions. He then went ahead and implemented the conditions, went and obtained the final approval before the city without protesting the conditions in any way, waited 2 years, and then sued the city for $600,000, asking for to be compensated for the value of the conditions which he now thought were unconstitutional. The Washington County Circuit Court said, no, you can't do that. You can't really have your cake and eat it too. That this sort of conduct where you don't assert your rights, where the city relies upon it, where it's too late now to change the conditions, that creates an estoppel. And they found that the developer hadn't protected its rights in a way and hadn't asserted its rights in a way that allowed them to now come into the city for damages. That case was affirmed by the Court of Appeals in a decision that, as I mentioned, came down this last March. The law in this area is developing. The issue about unconstitutional conditions arose through the Dolan case in an argument about the conditions itself, in an appeal from the imposition of conditions. The kind of case that's the subject matter of this bill is, as you know, a case where the land use process is completed, the conditions are implemented, and someone comes a year or two later and sues the city or the county for damages. I understand that this bill is in its final stages of adoption, and I'm not going to, and there are parts of it I think that local governments have supported. It represents a compromise between local governments and others who have interest in this area. And I only have some minor technical suggestions as to how the bill could be clarified, which I've discussed with Mr. Chandler and some of the others involved in the bill, and I wanted to lay them out real quickly for you, and then perhaps we can maybe try to work some of them out.
And you saw the proposed amendments that were presented just a moment ago?
I did not.
Okay, and they might address some of your concerns.
You may very well, yes. Very quickly, though, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, they are to first clarify the scope of the bill, ensure that it doesn't apply to conditions that are imposed before the bill goes into effect, because that would be very unfair, I think, for developers. If you had some conditions that you had a problem with, and they were imposed 8 months ago, and you have 2 or 6 years to complain about them right now, the bill goes into effect and says, now you have 180 days, and 180 days is coming up. So I think that the bill needs to say, this applies to stuff that's happening, you know, in the future. Secondly, the bill talks about challenges under this section, actions under this section, proceedings in circuit court. I think it needs to be, but it doesn't create any sort of claim for relief or new cause in the bill. So I think it needs to say this section applies to claims filed in state court seeking damages because of the imposition or unlawful imposition of conditions of approval of these different land use decisions. So it's to say what this section is about, and then the bill can technically start talking about claims filed under this section. Third, I think it needs to be clear that I think it's very fair that the bill say that just because you implement a condition doesn't mean that you're precluded from arguing about it or litigating it later on. Because I think developers are placed between a rock and a hard place sometimes when conditions are imposed and it's a question of going forward with the condition or stopping the action and having a 2-year time frame where they argue about the Constitution and its meaning. But at the same time, I don't think fairly that the bill should be an overturning of the Sherwood case. I don't think that the intent of the bill is to say that you can't have an estoppel defense ever to these sort of conditions. And I think the bill should be clarified that acceptance of the conditions by itself doesn't create a waiver, but that there might be other circumstances together with that that might create an estoppel or preclude the developer from bringing the claim. Because that is the law, that estoppel law sort of applies in hundreds of other sort of damage claims and situations like that. I have concerns, of course, about shifting the burden of proof. I realize that's a political compromise, and I only know technically that I have some legal concerns about whether or not the burden of proof can be shifted when the claim is a federal claim brought in 43 U.S. in Section 1983. And I have some concerns about whether or not state law can change that substantive aspect of the 1983 claim. And again, I appreciate the dynamics from the momentum. I was not involved in some of the prior discussions, even though I've been involved in a lot of litigation of these claims. And I realize that the process at this point is fine-tuning. I do want to plant a seed that I think that a cleaner and more elegant solution to this, perhaps for the next session, would be to have to change the legal review process. Instead of tinkering with the law of estoppel and evidentiary presumptions and whatnot and damage things, would be to say that a developer can appeal just the conditions of approval to LUBA and not appeal the rest of the decision, and to empower LUBA to delete conditions or overturn them and award attorney's fees to whoever is the victor. And if we had that incentive, it would mean that there wouldn't be frivolous appeals like that, but it would allow for an immediate working out of that issue, or else the local government would be subjected to attorney's fees and having the condition deleted by LUBA. That would be a much more clean way of approaching this issue. As it is, I think that unless this bill is tinkered with just a little bit, it's going to produce a lot more argument than sure.
Mr. Sirkin, have you met Mr. Chandler before?
Oh, yes, I have.
Well, he's standing right over here. And Mr. Chandler, we're not going to go into the work session on this today, but I'd appreciate it if you could meet with Mr. Sirkin and the other parties to work out the that the tinkering that needs to be done, we'll bring this back on Thursday if the amendments are ready. Would that... No, I don't think so. Once you come back with amendments on Thursday, that would be convenient. We have one other witness in opposition, Merlin Reeves. Merlin, before I call you, I'm going to interrupt this hearing because Representative Schrader is here, and we'll temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2474 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2805. It's a courtesy of the Senate and the House to allow representatives to testify, so speak out of order. Representative Schrader, if you'd come forward. And I have to step out to another meeting, so Senator Courtney will chair. We have 20 people signed up to testify on this bill, and our Senate convenes again at 3 o'clock. So as Representative Schrader testifies, for those witnesses who wish to testify, you're certainly welcome to. But as you hear testimony, if you just agree with what someone else has said, you don't need to repeat it. You can just say, I agree with the prior witness, or you can waive your time or emphasize your particular point. But here's what I'd like the committee to do today. We'll take 30 minutes of public testimony on the bill. Then we'll recess, and we'll go back to our other bills because I don't think they're in controversy, and so we can go into public hearing and work session on most of those. Then at 3 o'clock, we'll keep a member of the committee here to take the remainder of public testimony, so everyone who's here today will have an opportunity to testify on 2805, and I hope to be back in about a half an hour. So, Senator Courtney, thank you for taking over. And Mrs. Reeves, we'll go back to your testimony on this prior bill probably about 2:30, but I see you got one of those tags on, so you're probably here for two reasons.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity here. Colleagues, this is a bill that passed out of Representative Kurt Schrader, House District 23, for the record. This is a bill that passed out of the House 49-9, very popular bill. And I'll go through, I think, its basic elements. There was only one real semi-controversial section dealing with one word. And I promised my colleagues I would try and address that by talking to LC and investigating it further, and have done so and give you my opinion on that. House Bill 2805 protects citizens from frivolous lawsuits brought to discourage public participation in local government decisions, so-called strategic lawsuits against public participation. Specifically, the bill provides fairly broad, but not absolute, civil immunity for citizens for statements made in the course of participating in a public gathering for the purposes of influencing public opinion. It does not, however, it does not protect people from making knowingly false and immaterial statements to the issue being considered. It also requires that summary judgment motions filed by the defendant be expedited. So the chair and Representative Williams have a summary judgment bill coming through that you'll either see or have already seen that this bill was sort of piggyback on top of, just providing for expedition of that summary judgment. Well, after a growing problem nationwide, 10 states have adopted legislation, some of it is so far, and 10 more are working on it. In the last 8 years, unfortunately, there's been growing use of these types of slap suits by special interests to intimidate citizens from participating in the public process. And abuses have come from a wide range of sources. That would include agencies. It includes out-of-state type developers, includes landlords, just to name a few. While most of these lawsuits are dismissed, unfortunately, the citizen defendants, bear a lot of financial and emotional burdens they really cannot afford. In effect, they no longer feel comfortable speaking up in their community. And I think that's a terrible comment here, particularly in the state of Oregon. A couple quick examples. One gentleman from Banks testifying before city council about a subdivision and his view of how it would impact schools was subsequently sued for $18 million. Obviously a little crazy, but even though that was dismissed, he still ended up paying, he and his colleagues, about $18,000 in legal fees. A Columbia County commissioner had a recall petition filed against him. And the petitioners were notified if they did not withdraw that petition, they'd be sued. Because of that potential, they did withdraw and they no longer participate in the community planning process. Frankly, our judicial system wasn't designed, I don't think, to intimidate or punish citizens like this. They're clearly speaking out, trying to get their input in our communities, and that's what we've been asking for, stay involved. this bill would help prevent and cut down on the frivolous litigation, frees up our judicial resources we so dearly need to do the things they're supposed to be doing. And I think that basically if we're talking about good democracy, good citizen input, this is a real simple way you guys can send a real clear message to the people of the state of Oregon, hey, this is a good idea. We want you to come on down and speak. We want your opinion. The only controversy that arose on the House side was with regard to the immunity protection, and currently it reads that statements are known to be false and immaterial to the issue. There were some people that said, well, maybe it should be or, and they gave examples of how they thought that might be misused. I will tell you this, in 16 years of being on the Planning Commission in the city of Canby, I felt citizens were, if anything, much more careful with what they said and how they stated things than perhaps some other more professional type people that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. And they're really trying to do the right thing. I checked with Legislative Council. Legislative Council's here if the committee's interested. He felt that if you change that word from and or, it totally gets the bill. Makes it absolutely useless. You might as well not pass the bill. That's a pretty strong statement, I felt. And I tried to work around this several different ways with him. I'd also point out to the members of the committee that the state bar gives absolute immunity to lawyers when testifying amongst themselves on matters of concern. Absolute immunity, no exceptions. Shouldn't citizens have that same type of right, or at least something close? I'd also point to a 1984 precedent-setting court case in Colorado, the PLME test, basically. And the language they use is very similar to the language we have here. Basically, immunity would be granted unless it was shown that the testimony was devoid of reasonable factual support and had as its primary purpose harassment. Very, very similar to what we're talking about right here, using that and language. And finally, I point out that ORS 171-530, which is the portion of our state statute that deals with the immunity given citizens that testify before us, this is already current law, states, quite frankly, a statement made by witnesses before a legislative committee, which is pertinent to the matter, before the legislative committee, is privileged, and the witness shall not be subject to an action for civil damages as a result thereof, unless the witness knowingly makes a false and immaterial statement. So it's already law here, folks. It's already law right now for the people testifying here. You're going to hear perhaps some examples from others that want to testify about how this does all sorts of strange things. Before you jump to conclusions, I'd urge you to keep the language the same and help the citizens of the state of Oregon. It's a great bill, a great statement about what our legislature is all about and how we value citizen input, and I'd encourage your vote.
Thank you, President.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to commend you for pushing this legislation through. I was horrified when I first heard about these suits, and I think they are very appropriate. The acronym is very appropriate. They are truly a slap at democracy. I did have a question for you on the where the concept of immaterial came from. I certainly agree with you. We don't want to gut the bill, but I was surprised about the presence of the word anyway. Where did that come from?
I'd ask Legislative Council, if that's okay, Mr. Chair, to come up and help answer that question, since we had them draft the language. I think it was based in part on what we currently do have in the legislative arena right now.
Chair Courtney, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Deputy Legislative Counsel. Materiality goes back a long way in the law. It's primarily an evidence standard. It was basically a concept that was meant to differentiate between evidence in a trial that was was relevant or material. There were two different issues there. There were some things that simply were not at all related whatsoever to the proceedings before the court, and so they were immaterial. And basically, the language that we have now for the Legislative Assembly for testimony here incorporated that concept, and the still incorporates as well, which is basically that if you make some statement that just has nothing to do with the proceeding before the public body, it's immaterial and hence not protected. So if during the course of some proceeding you make some statement about a person that you know to be false and that just has nothing to do with what's before the body, you're not going to get the protections under the bill.
Okay. Thank you. I had a follow-up question as long as we have counsel up here, and that is the
grounds for the lawsuit is a slander type ground, right?
Chair Courtney, Senator Burdick, that's correct.
Okay.
That, as I understand it, that's the great majority of the last suits that have brought our defamation action.
So, Mr. Chairman, to follow up, are the grounds for slander more permissive than they are for libel under the definitions of libel? Is that what the problem is here?
Chair Courtney, Senator Burdick, I believe that the standards basically for libel and libel is a printed falsehood, you know, to be false. Slander is a verbal statement that you know to be false. The two standards are basically the same as far as the protections. The press has special rules, though, for printed things that the press puts out about people, and so they do have slightly different rules under libel for press things.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, the press's requirement under the New York Times versus Sullivan for public officials is more stringent, where they're allowed to say more if they're talking about public officials or in an area of public interest. So, in your view, does this kind of apply that same standard to ordinary citizens?
Sure, Courtney, Senator Burdick, it's slightly different because the press standard, the New York Times versus Sullivan standard, was actual malice. You had to go in and show basically a mental state of
reckless disregard of whether the facts were false or not.
Correct, exactly. So you had to go in and show whether or not the newspaper, when it printed this information, or the television station, when it made this statement, was out really to get the person, is what I think that standard stood for. This is slightly different in that basically, we're not going to be looking at mental states. We're going to look, did you know that, or should have known this should have been false, and was it really material to the proceedings? So it's a slightly different standard, and I don't know if you'd say it's more protective or less protective. Certainly it's more protective than what you have now.
Yeah, I agree with that. Thank you very much.
Good question. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, here we go. Fortune, Liz, and Joe. I'm a little worried about this. Before she Foster, I guess, it is, but well, I can't. League of Women Voters and Friends of Marion County, Joe. And let's see, I'm not going to cut anybody's testimony off, but it's got a lot of people that testify, so if you can, I notice that you all, at least you've all said you're for the bill, at least in terms of the X column, I don't know. This is Franklin. Sure, go ahead, Portia, please.
I'm Portia Foster, 350 Pearl Street, number 813, and I'm strongly in favor of this bill. I was, for all the reasons that Representative Schrader mentioned, those I have included some of those in my testimony, so I won't repeat them. In our case, in 1996, four members of the Friends of 804, who start 804 County Road and Hiking Trail, and the editor of the Walport local paper, were sued by the city attorney of Yahas for defaming him and his title insurance company in March. A year earlier, in our efforts to get the city of Yahas to abide by its planning ordinances, we had learned that the city attorney and his wife owned the title insurance company, which prepared the warranty deed for an undersized lot and presided over a hearing on variances without disclosing a conflict of interest. I wrote a letter to the editor pointing out these facts. That was the reason for the suit. I would have thought that my letter was covered by the First Amendment. I thought, this can't be real, but the judge did not dismiss the case. Instead, it was dragged on for a year and 8 months, culminating in a 5-day jury trial in November 1997. After suing us, the attorney took his name off the suit, thereby making it a suit against only his title insurance company. But the 12-person jury decided unanimously for us when they got the chance. However, the judge did not award us our attorney fees, which were around $10,000 each. I've always believed that in a democracy, citizens have a responsibility to participate and that government officials and city attorneys should be accountable for their decisions, but that did not seem to be the case. Instead of our defaming someone, we were defamed repeatedly and information denied to the public. The real facts have been suppressed, as well as open discussion of the issues. We've been falsely accused of all sorts of things, which have created a climate of hostility on the coast. From the beginning, we have sought mediation and dialogue, but so far that has been denied. I do not believe litigation usually helps to resolve conflicts. I'm sure that the public needs to be protected against lawsuits if we want people to participate in public forums. I hope no one in Oregon has to suffer what we've gone through in our efforts for the public good and responsible government. Thank you for hearing my testimony. Is there any questions I'd like to ask?
Thank you, Portia. Dave, would you like to?
Legal Women Voters of Oregon is a nonpartisan organization on this commission with some of the more than 1,300 members statewide. And its mission statement is to support for individual liberties established by the Constitution, the right of an individual to free and unencumbered speech is one of the most important requirements guaranteed in the U.S. Constitution. You will hear today good examples of some threatened and some real, brought against participating in one way or another in government decision making. These lawsuits are of deep conservative beliefs. When lawsuits are brought against citizens attempting to attack the security, they can be serious. The defendant is much more legal, sometimes enormous. And I might add, I personally helped bail a woman in Favalas out to a $7,000 lawsuit. We're having a number here. She got one, I got one. This was 7,000. Is well known for its advocacy of participation, and we're deeply concerned about the impact of such lawsuits on participation. One of the most egregious results of these lawsuits is the intimidating effect on citizen participation. No one, just to express an opinion, wants to be sued. No one chooses to spend time in court defending his or her reputation. No one wants to be left with the cost of this offense. Just one loss of travel of this nation leads to the potential of parenting not just one citizen, but many citizens. Not only is a community the poor of participation, our country is the poor for allowing the potential for intimidation. When you participate on the other side of the house, we are now participating here. We believe that the bill you have before you is an adequate, well-debated bill. I would push your hearing.
Joe? Senator Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Joe Kuhn, and I'm from Salem, Oregon. I'm a member of Friends of Marion County, Salem City Watch, and the group that is called Oregon Committee for Voice and Annexation. I'm going to be very brief and give you an anecdotal justification for this bill. A week ago, I was at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., and I went into the Gallery of Presidents, and I saw the portraits of Washington, Jefferson, and Adams. And I think it's very appropriate and very, very timely to mention this at this point. I'm frightened as a member of these groups for the testimony that I would give on issues of great importance to the citizens of Oregon. And I think we all need to be frightened about our First Amendment rights. And I think that these gentlemen in the gallery that I viewed in Washington, D.C. would be appalled at the big money special interests and the effects that it's having on muting citizen participation. And I would ask you to energize your fellow senators and to expedite this bill in its present form.
Other questions? Any questions? Thank you very much for coming here today and giving us your role and written testimony. Okay, Howard Payne, Evans from the Thousand Friends, and Daniel, Bates, Reese, Evan, Men, Bell, Nando. It's like the way from last name, so I just try to get it by with a purse, that way I don't offend too many people.
Howard, you'll be the first to go according to who signed up. I'm all about your signature, I guess. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Howard Payne. I'm representing the Alliance for Responsible Land Use in Deschutes County. We're a nonprofit land use watchdog organization. We have more than 100 members in the county. And our organization fully supports 2805. We believe it's time for Oregon to follow the lead that many other states have, passing legislation prohibiting SLAPs. Oregon's land use laws are based on public participation. It's not by coincidence that goal one is citizen involvement. We believe that citizens should have the right to speak out truthfully about developments without being faced with a slap suit. And to be brief, we highly support 2805. We ask that you pass it out of this committee with a due pass recommendation to the full full Senate. So thank you for the time to comment.
Thank you, Howard. Now, Evans, from the Positive Trends Oregon, Omaha, we had your first year, almost about your 2.5 pages for testimony. So
yes, I will be very brief. I will not read that. Sir, pardon me.
Well, we did write that.
Sir, Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Evan Mandel. I work for 1000 Friends of Oregon. I have four main points in support of 2805A and Gross. First, our statewide planning program success depends on local citizens participating in an open public debate and dialogue about the planning process and permitting decisions. 2805 protects that dialogue. Second, public debate belongs in the council chamber and on the street corner, but not in the courtroom. 2805 supports that debate. Third, the problem is lawsuit duration. These lawsuits end up being thrown out, but it takes a long time. They're not filed to be won, but to intimidate. Even if you win, you lose. 2805 changes that equation. And fourth, consider possible amendments you may see with lawsuit duration in mind. The proposals we've seen would greatly increase the length of lawsuits and not solve the problem, effectively gutting the bill. In sum, we need to protect those people who stand up to the civic challenge and get involved, and I urge your support of House Bill 2805.
Thank you, Evan. And now, Daniel, from Lynn Howard.
Chair Courtney, members of the committee, I guess I'll make this as short as I can. I have a copy of Goal 1 right here in front of me, and it's real interesting to me.
LCDC, Goal 1. Goal 1.
Correct. Right. Okay. Statewide planning.
Right. Okay. No, I just thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I could interject, goal one is the public participation goal of the land use planning program.
Right. I just wanted to thank you very much. Hey, yeah, right.
Oh, no problem. I don't know what I'm saying anyway.
No, that's you're fine. You're fine.
Any help you can give?
No, no. Daniel, you're doing fine, Katie. Right. Cool.
Anyhow, I represent some a group of people from Albany that we try to participate in our local government and in growth and development and everything. And most of these people want to stay anonymous though, because they're all very much afraid. Like a lot of Americans, my family and I are one paycheck away from being out on the streets. In which case, if we were hit with a slap suit, we would be on the street. And I think it's really unfair. It's something that is unnecessary. As angry and as upset as I get about some things, I know I try to be adult enough to make sure that what I am saying is fairly intelligent and at least very truthful in what I'm saying. And I think from my upbringing that as long as I'm being truthful and forthright and straightforward about things, I don't deserve to be sued for it. And I just think this legislation really as is right now needs to be moved forward as quickly as possible. I know there's other people out there that, again, like a lot of other Americans, are 1 to 3 paychecks away from being on the street, and it's a shame that we have to worry about this just to participate in the growth of Oregon. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Daniel. I'll be the time to find somebody to be frightful and scary.
I find it very intimidating because of the fact that you folks up there hold my family and my life in your hands, in which case I was brought up to believe that God should be the only one that really does that. And so it's very intimidating, but I do enjoy coming and seeing all of you. I've never been to the courtroom zoo, but I get a good charge out of this.
Okay, Daniel. Thank you, Daniel. Evan, how about any questions? Just a minute for Howard or Evan or Daniel. Any questions? Yes, Senator Burry.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question for Mr. Manville. The false and immaterial standards in the bill now, is that, in your view, adequate to address this issue? And
we have these dash 8 amendments that in front of us. I don't know where they came from, but basically we'll put a New York Times versus Sullivan standard of basically
saying facts that you know to be false or in reckless disregard of what whether they're true or false. As between those two standards, do you have an opinion as to which would be better?
My opinion is that the current standard in the bill would be better. And there are various reasons for that, but that's the short of it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Dennis Venable from Lynn County, Gary Scott, and Jeffrey. Right? I don't know. Maybe. Danny, do you know what your outline for us? I'm curious, I guess I got more. We can go back to the other bill instead, right? Maybe I can go back to you. Please go ahead, Dennis.
Hi. My testimony is very short. I had emailed all the committee members a copy of what I had for idea. I'll go ahead and read it to the record. The yes part of the anti-slap suit legislation will protect all Oregonians from frivolous lawsuits, which is designed to intimidate the public and the press. Having been to Luba twice and the Oregon Court of Appeals once over developments that were poorly planned and pushed through by a city process, I know how much attorney fees cost and to have to answer to all the off-the-wall lawsuits for trying to do what is right is ridiculous.
Thank you. Jerry Scott, please.
Premier Courtney, fellow chair members, happy to be here today. The SLAPs are civil lawsuits filed against non-governmental individuals or organizations because of communication to you guys or to the electorate on issues of public interest. In October 97, I received a threat from an attorney in regards to a voter pamphlet statement I submitted in report of the Salem ballot measure. If you persist, it said, the client intends to sue. The left on said was the implied, we'll slap you with a huge legal bill if you don't surrender. Divert the public's attention away from your cause and imply that you're wrong. Consume your time with legal process instead of your cause. And if you're intimidated at all, change your use of the data in the campaign. If your spouse disagrees with your response, they could destroy your marriage. By the time the suit is dismissed, the FCC measure will have been decided. The SLAP achieved its goals. All of that which was implied except for the huge legal bills happening in our FCC campaign. Even after the measure failed, and while the Statesman Journal was prompting the developers to prove the voter statement wrong, the public wondered, why would the developers spend money on a suit unless the statement is wrong? The developers spent no money on the suit and never provided any evidence that the statement was wrong, other than his assertion. The data was drawn from the public record provided by him and a building industry mouthpiece. The resulting damage to Salem is horrendous. Salem will continue to deteriorate. It is already over $400 million behind on previous growth-related needs for transportation alone that could have been covered by FCCs, but that no longer can be covered by FCCs because growth has occurred. And even if the new higher SEC levels the new council has established are implemented, the deficit will continue to grow, possibly by as much as $25,000 per new house. Remembering that SDCs pay only for that which the new properties consume, people won't vote in enough personal taxes to stop the decline. Indeed, they can't. Salem average income is already below a cost of living that's not dependent on public subsidies. It's easier to abandon the city. As one fellow whose house I appraised, who voted against the mayor, said, "Traffic has gotten so bad here, we're moving to Independence." And a Dallas realtor said, "My clients say they can get to their jobs in Salem just as fast from Dallas as they can from parts of Salem." A chart in Professor Russ Beaton's article I have attached shows that the higher the corporate welfare, in this case the public provided infrastructure, the poorer the economic conditions, and the lower the voter turnout. 10% in one of the examples we gave. I conveyed the above to you not because I believe House Bill 2805 clearly protects such appeals to the electorate. It doesn't. But to convey the damage currently done by even the threat of SLAP and to help protect those participating in the limited venues the bill may cover. If House had been courageous and less divisive, if it really wanted the input of knowledgeable electorate that would be involved, demand and vote for the protection of its best interests and the representatives that support said interests, appeals to the electorate would be clearly covered. Ultimately, that is the only way our democracy can survive. Instead, House Bill 2805 presents that half a loaf is better than none. Quandary. I have to support it. I'm not happy, but I have to support it.
Thank you. Jeffrey?
Jeffrey Lamb, Chairman, Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexation. This is some of the documentation that we have compiled, our organization has compiled, hundreds of pages, cases all over the state, that we subsequently took to the Citizen Involvement Action Committee of DLCD that kind of started this inquiry. How effective are SLAPs? We have members that aren't here today because they were advised by their attorney not to show up today and testify. They are currently trying to resolve frivolous lawsuits. So they're currently under the cloak of intimidation and fear and have been advised by counsel not to come here. Now, we have other membership that couldn't take a day off and travel 300 miles, 100 miles, 50 miles, and come up here and testify before you today. The issue is not development in land use only. This has to do with if somebody is dumping something into the river and you show up at the DEQ public hearing and the corporation that you're giving testimony against doesn't like what you have to say, they will sue you. This has to do with school curriculum. This has to do with consumer affairs. This has to do with every public policy issue that we deal with. And there's, of course, no better example than this body of the debate that goes on over public issues that people have strong, emotional, passionate feelings about one way or the other. But you guys don't threaten each other if you don't agree with each other. Something I said.
We'll be covered by this camera.
Most people will agree.
I think there is an ongoing lawsuit, isn't there?
Most people will agree that a threat is paramount to assault. It's hard enough for people to attend a DDQ meeting or a school board meeting or a city council meeting without the threat of being sued for voicing their opinion on public policy. not to mention that some councils will cut you off after 3 minutes when the jurisdiction is trying to deal with very complicated public policy issues. You'll get 3 minutes to get your 2 cents in, and that does not promote citizen involvement. Being sued for writing letters to the editor does not promote citizen involvement. Seeing the price that we're paying as a state and a society with cynicism and apathy undermining the very foundation of how we function. I think this session has a unique opportunity to send a strong message that our courts cannot be used to intimidate, inject fear, and assault our citizens for the mere purpose of taking part in the process, or we're going to have the whole process unravel on us. Flat suits are like a cancer. It's a national phenomenon. For every 1,000 that are identified by the Vanderbilt Freedom Forum, they say that there's a factor of 5,000 to 10,000 more that are not identified. So we're hopeful that this body will move this forward with a due pass recommendation. We feel that the language is adequate. You've heard much testimony about that. I appreciate very much the fact that the chair chose to expand the original timeline for us today. I know that you're very busy. We do have people that have literally waited 2, 3, 4 years to address you folks, have their 5 minutes, tell you how this has impacted their lives. They've come a long way, and so I'm very appreciative of the fact that you're going to accommodate everybody today. And I know that the chair is swimming in the sun. I think I've said what I have to say. You have the testimony before you. You've heard quite eloquent things from many people. Appreciate the opportunity to come up here today and talk to you all.
Thank you. Questions for Jerry or Jeffrey?
Well, just a comment, Mr. Chair. I've heard the people testify, and I think I'm pretty supportive of what you're trying to say. There was only one concern I had, I haven't read this bill. I just seen on the committee. I'm trying to catch up now. You're talking about the citizen input, which I really believe in, and even the chair of a committee. If you try to accommodate everyone, during the interim, I recall I had another room full of people, and this room full of people. I had a deadline. I had to have people out. So I really had to move everyone along. Someone wrote a scathing article later that I wouldn't even listen to people. There are times that you have to do something. And I was thinking about how you could almost, if you mentioned, my school background comes out here a little bit, I think you could get a hot curricular kind of issue, and you could almost bring a school board to a standstill. If you just try to say, hey, we're going to go in and everyone will come in, all those meetings will just constantly take up the public time and testify. There has to be some cutoff time. So I just didn't want to let that go. While I really believe in the citizen input, because you get good ideas, it's up to us, I know. There are points where sometimes you have to have some time limits, and I don't think you weren't saying that, but I just kind of want to get that on the record, that there are times where you do have to set some limits, and you can't give everyone they want as far as the time goes.
I believe I was appreciating the fact that we're late in the session, things are under a lot of pressure, and that we wanted to accommodate and acknowledge that you had, even with all these things going, still said that you would hear everybody today.
Well, I was thinking in general,
So nobody else speak ill of you today.
Okay. Along the lines, I know the advice chair wants to get us moving, but I received several emails and letters on this issue, and I just don't have the staff. I saw one from you. I don't have the time to respond to everyone. I try and limit my correspondence to constituents, so I just want to let folks know that
We do get your emails. I mean, I've got emails coming out of my ears on this issue. So I don't have time to respond to everyone on them. So, but I appreciate the input.
I'm glad you have emails coming out of your ears. Okay. We're doing our job.
You're doing your job.
I've just been giving my orders. Where we're at is I'm going to close the public hearing for a moment. I've got to do a whole bunch of other things. Then around the tree, we're going to come back to the rest of people. So that's where we're at. And so just hold tight if you could. Can't believe how much work they got ready for me to do here, us to do now. So thank you very much for your testimony. Just close the public hearing for a bit. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2474. Would Marilyn Reeves come forward, please? Is Marilyn here? Okay, Marilyn, you're going to speak this just briefly, please. Is that right? I mean, I'm sorry, folks, but
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Marilyn Reeves. I'm here today representing Friends of Yamhill County, an organization that has been involved with monitoring land use laws for many years. It is very appropriate that you are interrupting the hearing on SLAPS to go back to 2474, which may seem to some of you as just a technical bill. I would like to point out, however, that conditions of approval, which are attached to land use decisions, are very often the product of a great deal of compromise that's occurred during those hearings. And I am very concerned that what we are doing here is opening up the potential for this other kind of intimidation and this other kind of slap suit against municipalities and counties across this country, this state. Clearly, when you are asking that the burden of proof change and that the burden showing whether or not something is constitutional is now on the basis of local government, then I believe that this is a very serious issue. And I would urge that you look at 2474 very carefully. It has been designed, it seems to me, to once again have developers get out from under some of the requirements that were put on their approval process. In Yamhill County, what does this mean? It generally pertains to roads. We don't have adequate roads in our rural areas. It pertains to perhaps setbacks. It pertains to other variances that are very appropriate, and yes, it may pertain to fees. Now, it would seem to me that if we have these conditions of approval that have been agreed upon, for the developer to come back then and claim that was not constitutional, and you have changed the burden of proof, and you've made the local government then try to prove that that was constitutional. And I believe that you have in your packet, in regard back to the slap suit issue, when you have a community like Banks of 500 people, I am quite certain the mayor is not well paid, if at all. I am quite certain in our local communities there are not resources for constitutional lawyers. And so I would urge that you very carefully look at 2474. Do not hastily approve it. It is clearly not in the best interest of development. We need all the tools that we can get at this point of high growth for local government, and those tools include conditions of approval. And I believe that this is a sheep in wolf's clothing. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marilyn. Questions? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on 2474. Open the work session on House Bill 3576.
Mr. Chairman, members, you had this bill last Thursday, and if you remember, it was a bill that would exempt from public disclosure information, as amended, information about customers of the municipal electric utility, people's utility district, subject to certain exceptions that you see in the -A4 amendments, and also would exempt sensitive business, financial, commercial information furnished to or developed by a public body that's engaged in the business of providing electricity. The A4 amendments represent, the proponents of the bill were interested in seeing the exemptions phrased differently, and that's exactly what the A4 amendments represent to you right now. This is a language that is identical to what is in Senate Bill 1145 that's traveling through process.
1145 or 1149?
1149. headed through the process now. And the reason that the amendments are so long is because they are conflict amendments.
Okay. Are you, so where were you? Is this Liz Pratt? Liz?
She said she wouldn't wrinkle her nose, Mr. Chair.
All right. The chair moves the dash four amendments. The chair moves the dash A4 amendment to House Bill 3576. Is there any objection? Does anybody know what we're doing? Okay, you're going to have to because the meeting. What?
Are there folks that have concerns?
Diane Callen, Oregon PUD Association. The only amendments we've seen are the dash 3s. Mr. Chair, as I said, the dash A4 amendments resolve conflicts with Roe, and they resolve conflicts with House Bill 3218. They do not make a substantive change. They basically renumber where the exemptions would appear. In this bill, the number is number 25 and number 26 in the statute, and if in fact 3218 passes, the exemption will have to be number 27 and 28. One more question. Do they include the new language that were in the dash 3?
Yes.
Thank you. As I said, they represent what the proponents are asked for at the hearing on Thursday.
Anybody else? You okay? Okay. The chair moves House Bill 3576 as amended before due pass. Are there any objections? Okay, close the work session on 3576 and move to
a carrier
will be Senator Brown has agreed to carry that bill. House in the work session on how and public hearing work session on House Bill 2684. Mr. Nass, would you come forward please and speak with us in a second?
Mr. Chair, my name is Jim Nass, Legal Counsel, Court of Appeals. House Bill 2684 is designed to make clear when appellate judges may participate in cases where the law is not so clear that they can now. The bill does a number of other things, but that's the basic rest of the bill.
Well, okay.
If you want me to say more, I'm certainly...
Okay. So hopefully, I think we need a little more,
okay.
A little more on that than just, don't get me wrong, I realize it's just a little more than that.
Yeah, a little more. So basically, four things.
I had trouble with that one, and of course, I'm not real frank. A little more than let the judge do something they can't do right now.
Right.
I don't mean to make fun of you, sir, Mr. Miller, but.
There are basically four things that this bill does. It makes more clear, as I said, the circumstances under which an appellate judge may participate in a case, even though that judge was not present at oral argument. And the need for that has come up because in the past 2 years, Justice Taylor left the court, Justice Fairburn on the federal bench, Justice Dusty came on and couldn't sit on all cases involving the state. So it was hard to get enough judges to play on some cases. So this bill allows judges who have come onto the bench to participate in the case, even though they weren't present or argument. Second thing that the bill does is it would permit the practice that goes on in trial court as far as I know, forever and ever, of one judge hearing a case and having some other lawyer, if it is some other judge, sign the order or judgment because the judge who actually heard the case is out of the office, either retired, or may have died on an extended trip, extended illness. Third thing is that it would make clear that the proper way to raise the issue of whether to disqualify an appellate judge is by a motion to remove the judge rather than to change the place of trial, which due to some unusual and archaic language in the statute may be the only way to ask to get rid of the judge now. And lastly, it makes sure, codifies the current practice that the judge may not participate in a case if the judge in some other lower forum participated in the decision there, such as a circuit judge becoming a court of appeals judge or a workers' compensation administrative law judge becoming a circuit judge. Questions?
Thank you. That was helpful. I'm sorry, Heather. Questions? Very good. Thank you very much. Okay, Lord and High Council on the phone. You ready to go? Oh, that's what happens. You're on the phone. Are there any amendments? Are there any? We're in work session. No, I said public hearing talks of work session. That's how I cover that. We're in work session.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move the bill to form the past elimination.
The Senator Brown moves House Bill 2684 as is to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there any objections? Hearing none, it is done. I'm going to share that one, if you don't mind. Unless somebody else, you want to share anybody else? You want to share this? Okay.
You're the one who asked all the questions.
Yeah, I did, didn't I? All right, open the public hearing and possible and work session on 2256. Who we have here? Lynn Larson, Department of Justice, please. I assume this will be a very much good point and a little situation here. Thank you for giving me. Other than a chair against a vice chair, the power of science. Yeah, go ahead, please.
I gave you my testimony. Any questions?
I'm going to you.
Actually, I do.
Could you just say, okay, just quickly,
Lynn Larson from the Attorney General's office. This bill has come from the House without opposition.
Okay.
Essentially, what it is a state version of the Federal Prison Litigation Reform Act that in substance it makes inmates pay for filing fees if they have money, and it sets up a three strikes provision similar to the federal bill that if you've had three cases either deemed to be frivolous or you've lost, it's been dismissed for failure to state a claim. The court cannot waive fees. It does not apply to post-conviction state habeas or mandamus. So it's basically for tort claims. State tort
claims. Okay. That's what I have. I have your right. Are there questions on this bill?
Mr. Chair, just for your information, we do have conflict amendments to resolve conflicts with the...
Okay.
I move the dash A2 amendments
to House Bill 2256. Are there objections? All right. Everybody ready to go on the bill as it stands in the written and the verbal testimony?
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to floor to be passed recommendation as amended.
Thank you. Senator Brown moves House Bill 2256 as amended to floor to be passed recommendation. Any objections? The chair will carry the bill. Thank you very much. Thanks, buddy.
Good.
No problem. Just quickly, and I'll give it to you. Should I just move to the next one?
Yes, please.
Please open the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2705. Paul Romaine, Pat Egan, Barb Hutchinson, and Marge Gafori. Please come forward all at once. And I think you've been watching us, so you know that the two of you, we got everybody for it but one, but I guess we just start with Paul for your show. Who would be appropriate to start? Would it be you, Pastor, if it was initially your bill, or go down this way? Okay, fine. Whoever wants to begin, please do so.
I'll go. For the record, Barb Hutchinson with the Liquor Commission. The A.N. Gross version of the bill, which included a piece that dealt with a very well-publicized establishment in Salem where there was exotic dancers and they were giving away free beer. We felt strongly, along with Senator Courtney, that we wanted to close a loophole in this particular bill. So we're very in favor of that. There has been a dash, I don't know which it is, A5 amendment, that we have a little bit of difficulty with a premise. By definition in the statute, is a licensed premise, and so we need to say place of business or something like that. There are some problems in terms of intent here, but I think we can work everything out in rulemaking. So in terms of that piece of the bill, we're fine. Should I come back to the license? Okay.
Just cover that if I could, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Pat Egan, for the record, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. I think this will clear out your dash A5s. Looking at the original version, or the main gross version of the bill, Section 8 there simply says there shall be no giving away of alcohol, period, if you're not a licensed establishment. We asked and got the consent of OLCC, I think, to go ahead draft amendments that would exempt out or at least keep the intention of Section 8 on businesses that also are providing entertainment or providing food and beverage. We think the A5s accomplished that and would still allow the giving away of a bottle of wine, say, at a Norm Thompson or a Nordstrom, a non-OLCC licensed retail establishment, and that's the intent of the dash A5s. Keep that out.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. I'm here both in support of the bill as it is, as it will be amended, and for I encourage you to put in the A4 amendments, which are right here. First, let me speak to the main body of the bill, which I don't think anybody really spoke to. This really started out as a very good bill, which we think is an excellent idea, which is getting people between the ages of 18 and 21 who have a problem into some kind of diagnostic assessment and treatment. That was the guts of this bill. And that's a very good thing, and we want to tell you that the industry wholeheartedly supports that. If we can diagnose these people early and get them into some kind of treatment, that's a very, very good thing to do. The second thing, which was added in the House and you're clarifying, is the scores bar, which was, I just want to go on record of believing that telling you that your current law, I believe, prohibits sale of alcohol to scores or scores sale to the public. I don't think they can give it away or do anything like they were doing without a license. I still advise all of my distributors, and to my knowledge, the distributors would not sell to scores. And my understanding is they would go down to retail establishments and pick up the alcohol. So we believe under current law that you couldn't go that far as scores wanted to go, and we hope that this amendment that you're adopting clarifies it even further. If nothing else, it's good for the public to understand that you can't do this kind of stuff without a license. The guts of my testimony really deals with the dash A4 amendments, which you have in front of you, and they deal with a problem that is on its way to getting resolved, thank God. The original reason for this was back in 1989, the legislature passed Senate Bill 126, which is a good bill. It basically gives the Liquor Control Commission some authority to deal with problem establishments. And in those things that the Liquor Control Commission could consider in renewing a license or canceling a license, there were a number of things that were listed by the legislature. Among them, fights, trespassing, public urination, all types of things. And one of the categories was noise. Well, most of the categories that are listed are very easy to define, but noise is very difficult to define. It really never became an issue until about a year ago. About a year ago, we got the first cases coming up in the Liquor Control Commission where it was only noise that was the basis for cancellation. And the problem with noise is one person's noise is another person's music. So how do you determine what it is that actually can cancel a license? There were a number of places, one of them in Mountain Park in Lake Oswego, a place called Hanko's, where the nature of the beast means that the people who live above it are going to hear everything that occurs in the parking lot. For example, if you've ever been to Mountain Park, it's basically a natural bowl. They should have put an amphitheater there. Because if you're at the restaurant, outside in the parking lot, the sound naturally travels up the hill right into the residences above the place. But it's zoned properly, and all the people are doing is talking, maybe sometimes talking a little loud, but nothing out of the normal, slamming their car door periodically. A car alarm would go off, and those complaints became the basis of a cancellation notice from the Liquor Control Commission, because there were a number of complaints. They went on the numbers of complaints. Second one, which you might have read about, concerned a restaurant in Northwest, which is called Paragon, where, in effect, you had a few people who were complaining about activity, and what that activity was, most of the activity was loud cell phone talking, doors, slamming of doors, people going outside, walking down the street, talking loudly. And the question came up, what is it that constitutes actionable noise? Is it normal restaurant, outside of restaurant activity, or is it something more? And what the Liquor Control Commission was saying, they would not establish those standards. We introduced some legislation originally to another bill that said you have to, basically very similar to what you have in front of you, saying we need standards. At that point, the Liquor Control Commission came forth and said, we'll do it by rule, which is what we had been asking them for in the first place. They have gone ahead and they are going into rulemaking on this. And they had this last, yesterday actually, adopted a noise policy, which basically says, and I'll read you this, the guts of it, the last of it, it says, if the licensee has taken reasonable steps to control patron noise, meets local noise ordinances, and the noise is not other than that expected for the type of zoning in the neighborhood, there will be no violation found. But it took a long time to get there. And that is simply a policy that has been adopted by the commission. It is not a rule, and it can be changed. We think that what you need to do is define in the law general parameters for the Liquor Control Commission and everybody to know about. And what A4 does is do three things. One is, it says that if it's noise from inside the licensed premises, this is A, line A, if it violates a noise ordinance, then it's actionable. In other words, local control, the local government is given the option, they have a noise ordinance, they control how much noise is acceptable from inside. And that's fair. The manager of the restaurant, the owner of the restaurant, has total control over what happens inside that restaurant and should be subject to sanctions if they violate a noise ordinance. Noise caused by patrons outside a restaurant, it's key to talk about patrons, people who have been in the restaurant, not people coming by, not people who walk up to the restaurant and are refused entry into the restaurant because they happen to be inebriated. In fact, one of the complaints against one restaurant was, frankly, that some people were making noise outside. People came up to the restaurant. The guy was so drunk, he was refused admittance. He went out and made noise outside, and the restaurant was actually, that was one of the listed violations because the guy was allowed outside the restaurant. The restaurant had refused to let him in. So what this says is that if it's caused by a patron outside the restaurant, it either has to violate that noise ordinance or, and this is the key, be of the type of noise that is not, that a reasonable person would not expect to hear outside of a restaurant. Still gives plenty of discretion to the Liquor Control Commission to decide what to do. The final thing is the people who are complaining about the noise have to do something, if it's possible, to mitigate any problem if they can. For example, close the window. One of the problems in the Mountain Park area, these are air-conditioned condominiums, and the people want to sleep with their windows open. Well, if you sleep with your window open, you are going to hear everything outside that place. The problem arises because you are getting density zoning. You're getting unique kind of zoning now. It used to be that you had neighborhoods where you had people living in homes, you had commercial areas, and the two very rarely really mixed. You're now, as a necessity, and because they're desirable places, getting areas like the Pearl District, like downtown Portland, like Northwest 23rd, other places in other cities, where you're getting mixed use, and you've got to have some kind of standards. What the A4 amendments do is set those standards basically in the statute and then allow the Liquor Control Commission to do rules around those standards. But the basic thing is, if it's reasonable, if it's something you would normally expect to hear outside of a restaurant, then, and it's properly zoned, and you're in the right area, then it's not actionable. You can't lose your license for that. Thank you. Be happy to answer any questions.
On line 10 of your amendments, Paul, the dashboard, should and be or? Because otherwise you'd have, it's conjunctive, and you have to do both A and B.
Yes, that was...
Let's treat that as a scrivener's error.
Yeah.
Questions for these witnesses? Thank you. We have one more witness, Marge Corey.
Yes, Marge.
Just for the record, again, Senator Brown, Brian, with the Liquor Commission. We're not opposed to the statutory language per se, but our commissioners and our administrators feel that public policy would probably be better served were this to be done through rulemaking. They have already initiated rulemaking on this in April. They adopted a temporary policy yesterday. This is going to take some time. Neighbors need to have an opportunity for input. And we believe if we could all sit down at the table together that we'd probably end up with a better product.
Thank you.
Marge. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Marge Kapoor, representing the City of Portland. And Ms. Hutchinson has touched on the reason why I'd like to ask you not to accept the Dash 4 amendments to this bill. As you heard, the OLCC has agreed, as I understand it, to undertake a process of rulemaking around the issue of noise. And as I understand it, what this entails is that the OLCC will conduct a number of hearings that will involve both neighborhood interests and business interests to develop and refine a policy that works for everyone. We are sympathetic to situations where a particular establishment might be subject to overzealous complaining neighbors, and that is where we have gotten involved from time to time with instances like that in our city. We have neighborhood associations in our city, as you know, and we have licensees who come up for renewal from time to time. Most times, the neighborhood associations and the licensees are willing to sit down and work issues out, and we affect that and try to make that happen, and that is the preferred outcome for everyone concerned. In some very small instances, that does not work, and during license renewal, those issues generally come to City Council, and City Council will make recommendations to the OLCC about the conditions under which licenses should be renewed. That has happened in a particular instance in Northwest Portland. However, I think that this issue should be left to the OLCC. This is the state agency that is responsible for developing rules around issues like this. They are the best ones to invite everybody concerned to come and talk to the OLCC about those issues and to express their feelings and to come together and produce a policy that really works and not do something at the last minute in a legislative body. So I would ask that you set these aside.
Questions? Thank you, Justin.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask you a question of the OLCC?
Yes, Mark.
In light of the City of Portland testimony, I really share the concern about people moving in against a commercial area and then complaining. It's kind of like somebody who moves into a flight path of an airport and then complains about the airport noise. So specifically, is the OLCC developing regulations that will address in this amount of detail the concerns of the neighbors and the establishment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I would hope that would be the outcome. The Liquor Commission finds itself in a kind of awkward position here in that we've got 38 sectors statewide. We've got some public safety issues that we clearly have to make a priority for. And we don't really like being the noise cops, but I think through a rulemaking process that we can come up with some standards that would work for everybody.
And you'll bring all sides to the table when
you're developing those? Mr. Chair, Senator
Burdick, yes. The standards that your temporary rule adopts, as I understand it, are the same standards that are in the Dash Correct.
Correct. Yes, you can.
Thank you. Senator Brown?
So, since we're used to being the bad guys, why not frame the policy on us as opposed to you all doing the rules?
The chair is not used to being a bad guy. We'd be happy to invite you to the rulemaking process if we get that far.
We have a call of the Senate. So we will be in recess. Let me explain what a call of the Senate is for those who don't know. That means the senators have to return to the floor of the Senate. If we don't, we're subject to arrest by the state police. And theoretically, you can go to jail. Now, that's never happened to any of us, but we try to obey our president. And we will return to take the remainder of the testimony on 2805. The other two bills we have today, we will reschedule shortly. So with that, we will be in recess.
We will take the testimony on 2805 after a very brief presentation on House Bill 3052. So with that, I will open the public hearing on House Bill 3052.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the District Attorney Association. I would advise you that House Bill 3052 was the result of a work group comprised of law enforcement representatives, ACLU, proponents of the ballot measure. Our goal was to implement the will of the voters in passing the medical marijuana provision, but to also prevent the commercial illegal abuse of this process for medical marijuana. There is a handout that's being provided. Oregon law enforcement supports this because it does several things. It keeps medical marijuana out of the jails and prisons. It clarifies that police are not obligated to continue growing marijuana that is seized. It does limit the number of locations for medical marijuana and has some provisions that we believe prevent illegal commercial grows. And it allows that the custodial parent of a child would be the parent that has medical authority over the child would be the person who can give permission for medical marijuana under the Act. We think all of those are positive changes, still implements the will of the voters. This bill passed the House, we believe, 58-1. 49-8. Mix that up. But there is one opponent to the measure on the House side and also here. Those complaints were voiced to the House as well. But with that, we support it. There is one amendment that needs to take place, unfortunately. On page 2 of the bill, line 2 and 3, there is bolded language there. A person may serve as a designated primary caregiver for only one person. In the amendment process, that should have been stricken, and it was not, and that we did not notice that before it got into the engrossed version. But that one amendment should take place. Other than that, we believe it accurately portrays the negotiations and the agreements of all the parties, and we believe it's a good bill.
And is this problem something that the work group agrees is a problem?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Kevin Campbell with the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I just wanted to echo Dale's comments and to mention that the participants from our perspective were the members of the Oregon Law Enforcement Legislative Committee, so that it would include the chief, sheriffs, district attorneys, state police, and the Portland Police Bureau, as you know all too well. And so I just wanted to mention that for the record. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We'll do my gun balance as soon as we finish it.
Okay, there you go.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Amy Clare, representing Oregonians for Medical Rights. You have my written statement. I would like to emphasize again that those lines 2 and 3 should be restricted from the bill. They actually weren't even in the House adopted amendments, so it really is an error. The committee adopted amendments that didn't contain that language is very problematic for us. We would absolutely oppose the bill, actually, if that were kept in. I'm sure.
Thank you very much. We
appreciate your thanks for that, and thank you for your time.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. was David Sedanke there here who has signed up? Okay.
He echoed what we had to say. He put the proponent side.
Thank you very much. Leland Berger from Voter Power.
Good afternoon. I'm here on behalf of which is a political action committee that was formed about a year ago. We organized the grassroots activists in enacting ballot measure 67, the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, and in defeating the referendum on ballot measure 57, which would have recriminalized less than an ounce of marijuana by a 2-to-1 vote statewide in a majority in every county. Additionally, we registered 10,000 people to vote, and we intend to register an additional 10,000 this year and next. Madam Chair, I testified in front of the House committee and two, and I just want to tell you pretty much what I told them, which is that, the other thing I need to tell you in terms of my qualifications is I served as the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association representative to the Health Division's Advisory Committee on the medical marijuana rules, which were went into effect April 29th, subject to possible judicial review if there's an appeal of some of the problems that arose in the rules. The simple, short point of it is that the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act ain't broke and it don't need fixing. The concerns that law enforcement has persuaded the other participants in the work group are the hypothetical problems that they are guessing might come up and haven't come up, and if they do come up, could be dealt with in the 2000 legislature. Some of the proposed amendments are pretty insignificant and insubstantial. For example, the Act provides that if the patient is a minor, that a parent has to approve it. Clearly, in the case of a divorced family, the parent who would only have authority to approve it would be the one responsible for health care decisions. Excuse me. So you can see on page 1, lines 1 through 16, where it makes those changes are not necessary, but if those were the only changes being made, I wouldn't have come down here today, and I certainly wouldn't have stayed for a couple of hours to have the opportunity to testify before you. In Section 3, it makes several changes. First, it exempts from the protections of the Act the use in a correctional facility or in a youth correctional facility. First of all, this is not likely to be a problem, actually, as both the Parole Board and the Oregon Youth Authority and the Corrections Division all have rules regarding inmates who have serious physical medical conditions that allow early leave and release. So the other thing is that amending the law in this fashion invites a lawsuit. It's probably unconstitutional to say that a medical benefit that's extended to all people is not extended to people because they're incarcerated. The change in subsection E of Section 3, limiting the places where marijuana can be produced under the Act, if the medical marijuana were produced anywhere other than at the patient's home or at the caregiver's place, at a third party's place, that third party would have no protection under the Act. So it's really an unnecessary amendment. However, it could come up in the course of things that a caregiver and a patient would be unable to grow. For example, I've received calls from people who are, I guess I also forgot to tell you, I practice primarily criminal appellate work, but I've been defending medical marijuana patients over the last 4 years in Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Coos, and Josephine counties. And I get calls every day or every other day from either patients or lawyers about this Act. And I have received several calls from people who are either in Section 8 housing, people in veterans hospitals, about being unable to cultivate medicine at their location, and it could come up where there was both the patient and the caregiver were in that situation, and a third person's location was necessary. The rules that have been drafted by the health division allow but do not require the patient to designate the location where the medicine is being cultivated. This will change that, and it would change it unnecessarily. The part that erroneously was included in the measure that passed, or in the version that passed the House that the previous witnesses told you ought to be deleted, I'm concerned is duplicated by subsection F, manufactures or produces marijuana at more than one address. I also neglected to tell you that I assisted in drafting this act. That was one of about a dozen people that helped draft the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. And our thinking at the time was that that caregivers ought to be able to take care of more than one patient, and same way that businesses have plant watering services that come around where people come around and tend to their plants in their office. And this, I think, as drafted, would preclude a caregiver from assisting in the production of marijuana for more than one patient. And for the same reason that the work group, which I did not participate in, felt that the amendments that was erroneously included in the version that passed the House is a problem, so too is this a problem. Section 4 guts the affirmative defenses and the choice of evils defense, which are, more than anything else, the Oregon part of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act. As I think the chair is aware, seven states now have medical marijuana laws. Much of the drafting and coordination of the campaigns occurred out of state, but as a part of the drafting process, it was essential to the Oregonians involved in the drafting that the affirmative defenses exist and that they not be tampered with. Essentially, the way the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act is constructed, patients who register and designate caregivers who grow within the limits prescribed by the Act are exempted from arrest and prosecution. We wanted, through the affirmative defenses, to allow two exceptions for that. The first exception would be and a lesser level of protection. In other words, you wouldn't be exempt from arrest or prosecution, but you could assert an affirmative defense when the case went to trial. The first exception was for people who could qualify for the Act, could be able to register, but for whatever reason, distrust in government, insecurity about the confidentiality of the health division's registry, chose not to. And we didn't want those people to be exempted because one thing law enforcement and the proponents have agreed on is that people should register, but we also didn't want people hung out to dry, so we included an affirmative defense. What the House has done is modified that to require that the person has been diagnosed with a medical condition within 12 months prior to arrest. It's a purely arbitrary pick a date out of the hat kind of thing, and I think it's in response to a law enforcement concern that people who would be arrested after they get arrested would go see a doctor and go get a diagnosis. And I can tell you that in California, there is already case law that says that you don't get the benefit of the defense unless you did the things that you need to do before you were arrested. So again, this is just unnecessary, and it will exclude people who really the voters intended to protect. The second group of people that we wanted to protect with an affirmative defense was.
Can I interrupt for just one second? I'm got a time constraint, too, and I'm just wondering if you're going to expect to be able to wrap this up maybe in another 3-4 minutes?
Yes.
Great.
The other concern we had was for people who, in trying to get this passed, we chose arbitrarily low limits on the amount of marijuana that patients could grow. Some kind of patients with sarcoma, for example, who need a greater supply, ought to have available to them the affirmative defense. And what the House has done is to arbitrarily require that determination to be made by the person's physician. And the proof of whether it's necessary or not is going to come from lots of places, but it shouldn't be restricted to the person's physician. And lastly, and most significantly, the amendment to the choice of evils defense requiring that the patient has taken a substantial step to comply is just unnecessary and really guts the intent of that fail-safe provision. I can tell you that there is a case pending in the Court of Appeals, State versus Jack Owenby, O-W-E-N-B as in boy, Y, who's argued the end of March. Dave Zegner from the State Public Defender's Office represents Mr. Owenby. Judge Rosenblum in Multnomah County had refused to allow Mr. Owenby to put on a choice of evils defense. So that issue is in the courts. And the inclusion of the choice of evils defense in this act was really in response to Judge Rosenblum's rulings and other rulings around the state where prosecutors prevailed on judges to deny juries the opportunity to hear all the facts. Lastly, the act amends Section 8 to say, quote, a law enforcement agency has no responsibility to maintain live marijuana plants lawfully seized. And the thinking at the time when we drafted the act was twofold. First of all, if law enforcement seizes, say for example, I had diabetes and I'm driving on Martin Luther King Boulevard in Portland near my home, and I was pulled over by the police and there were syringes on the front seat, because that's what diabetics use to inject insulin to stay alive. And the police seized the syringes, they would have to return those syringes to me once I showed them that that was my medicine or the means by which I used my medicine. The police have a duty of care as a bailee for seized property that can be ultimately be returned. And in any event, the idea isn't that the police would erroneously seize medical marijuana. I met with Mike Shrunk, the district attorney for Multnomah County, after the act passed, and suggested to him that in the same way they have an on-call deputy, if there's a homicide, or an on-call deputy for search warrant cases, we have an on-call deputy for medical marijuana cases, where a policeman could call in and say, you know, should I take this, should I just take a clipping and videotape it? There are, Madam Chair, two real problems with the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, which are not addressed by House Bill 3052. One of them we tried to solve in House Joint Memorial 10. House Joint Memorial 10, as amended by Chair Mannix, would have respectfully requested that Congress modify the legal status of marijuana to allow limited medical use in those states where limited medicinal use has been made legal under state law. HJM 10 passed out of committee, but it died on the House floor. The other problem is that at the hearing on House Bill 3052, Dr. Higginson from the Health Division announced that patients were going to be required to pay $150 to register. And this is twice what they charge anybody else for any other registration. And they have made no, notwithstanding that I faxed the materials used by the Multnomah County Circuit Court for deferred fees and filing fees in civil cases, they made no efforts to figure out how to avoid the lawsuit that is likely to occur when they deny a patient simply because he's unable to afford to pay the fee. So if you want to amend this and help medical marijuana patients, amend this to include some funding so that the health division can issue cards to people who can't afford it for free or reduced fee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Grant, you want to testify?
Senator Burdick. For the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the State Health Officer and Deputy Administrator for the Oregon Health Division. Yes. And the reason that the Health Division is involved in this issue is we're primarily, the reason why, is that we are responsible for the registration system so legitimate medical marijuana users can get a registration card that designates that they are a legitimate user. We were not part of the work group that people have spoken about, but we have reviewed the amendments and spoken with people on both sides of this issue. We do not see anything in the amendments that would hinder the registration system in any way. We would have to go back and do some minor tweaks to the rules and modify a little bit the registration system database, but otherwise there are no problems that we could see, and we're fine with the amendments that they can.
Thank you. And just very quickly, what was the basis of the $150 fee?
Well, the Senator Burdick, the fee, the Act itself states that the Health Division can charge fees, and that right now is the only way that we have to recoup the costs. And so when we originally started planning this, we let people know that our estimate was going to be for $150 per registrant per year. When we had our first advisory committee meeting, which Mr. Berger spoke about, proponents of the Act raised the issue that this really was a high fee, and we agreed. And we said that we would go back and see if there were additional resources that we can find. We went to the Department of Human Resources, we went to the Governor's Office, and were told by both those people that they really could not see within existing budget where additional funds could be found. I've already addressed this on the House side as well when we gave testimony. This is a fee that we also agree is too high, but right now it's either we charge that fee or we don't see how we can operate the registration system. So unfortunately, that's where we are.
All right. Thank you very much. Anybody else? Okay. With that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 3052 and reconvene the hearing on House Bill 2805. Larry DeBates and David Engen. Here. Good, you're both still here. Sorry for the delay. We're in session up there, and I couldn't leave until we had 20 members on the Senate floor because they can't do business with less than 20. So,
thank you, Senator. My name is Larry DeBates, and I live in rural Yamhill County. And about 2.5 years ago, I was asked to serve on the Citizens Involvement Advisory Committee for LCDC, representing that congressional district. One of the things that I found as soon as we got on there were quite a few things that were inhibiting good public involvement in the process. And one of the most overriding things was the slap suit issue. So we asked the Attorney General's office to kind of give us some briefing on that and bring forth any information they had on this. So they brought forth some briefing material and showed us that what other states had done in this particular area. And so we asked them to draft some legislation that would give some correction. And eventually the commission approved our request to have some draft legislation sent over. And that's where the bill came from originally. And then Representative Schrader ably picked it up and started carrying it through the House. And then Jeff picked up the political aspect of it, and Jeff Lamb did a tremendous job bringing the people to the table who need to be to the table. Now, I think this is a good example of democracy at work. The people you've heard testify here and before the House were people that are out there, and they have no vested interest in the same, except they're trying to get good public involvement in processes. You don't have any lobbyists in here testifying for it or even against it. I did see an amendment was just floating around the hall a little bit ago that somebody had put up a proposed amendment, AA for something, that's trying to sabotage a little bit of what's in the bill already. But as a member of the committee and as a private citizen, I strongly urge you to send this to the floor with a due pass. I think it's good legislation. I think it's good public policy. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I might just ask people's indulgence here. We have a limited period of time, so if you can keep your comments short, and especially if you agree with each other, and I say this as someone who is very sympathetic to what you're saying. So.
Yeah, Senator Burdick, my name is Dave Engen. I live here in Salem, and I think the act should be, or the law should be called the Defense of Democracy Act. because it's really important to the citizens that they have the threat of having to go through a legal process to defend themselves for a frivolous reason when they come forward to actually partake in the democratic process in this country. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Next we'll have Henry Reeves, Marilyn Reeves, and Terry Fleming. We meet again, Mr. Reeves, on another good cause.
It's a pleasure to see you again.
It is indeed a pleasure to see you.
The testimony of Senator Kirby. I'll defer to my wife first, and then I'll...
That's sensible. Senator Burry, excuse me, Senator Burry, yeah, I'm right the first time.
I forgot to change it.
My name is Marilyn Reeves. I'm here on behalf of Friends of Yamhill County. I want to put our organization strongly on record in support of this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I have copies of my testimony here, and so I'll be rather brief, but I do want to touch upon a situation in Minnesota that I'm very familiar with. And this started about 7 years ago when a very good friend of mine was sued by a developer for his protesting in official meetings about the project that he had in mind. And to make a very long story short, it's a painful story. The developer sued my friend for $50,000 claiming defamation of character and harm to his business. The suit dragged on for nearly 3 years, during which the Hawkinses incurred legal costs of about $25,000, an amount they could ill afford. Fortunately, my friend Hawkins is very well respected in the Twin Cities area of Minnesota, and his friends came to his aid and were able to raise enough money to cover his expenses. But other citizens became fearful that they, like my friend Hawkins, could be sued for simply exercising their right to free speech. And so concern over this issue developed, and Senator Jane Clinch of the Minnesota legislature introduced the anti-slap suit legislation, and she pushed through for its passage. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with politics in Minnesota, but these folks don't do anything very unanimously, and you can look at the recent gubernatorial election in that respect. But her bill passed unanimously in the Minnesota Senate and almost as handily in the House. Well, why am I bringing this up? Well, I well recall when my friend Hawkins told me of this, I assured him that this could not happen in Oregon. And the reason it couldn't happen in Oregon is because we are renowned for our efforts to promote and provide for public participation at all levels of government. And secondly, on land use issues, Goal 1 is specifically related to public participation. So how wrong I was in telling Ken Hawkins that this could not happen in Oregon. Since that time, of course, many states have passed anti-slap legislation, and Oregon should also. I'd like to refresh your memory here this afternoon that we heard testimony on House Bill 2554, which related to liabilities of doctors and dentists for performing uncompensated services. And probably such a remedy is correct. But here we're talking about not liabilities of only doctors and dentists, but we're talking about citizens. All citizens in the state of Oregon who wish to exercise their rights of public participation. Therefore, I urge you to pass House Bill 2805 and with it include a group pass recommendation to the Senate. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Terry, and your assistant.
Yeah, Senator Burdick. I'm Terry Fleming, and this is my son, Colin. And you've heard a lot this afternoon about the whys of why to pass this legislation. I've heard one other person, this lady, talk about what it's like to be a target and feel like you have a big target attached to your back. And I'd like to tell you a little bit. that because I think it's important to get an inside view of what SLAPS is really all about. Several years ago, four to five years ago, I joined a small group of people in the town that I'm from, Banks, Oregon, and we were fighting not a developer, but a city council, or really a mayor, that had ramrodded through a development, so to speak. He had disbanded the planning commission, had basically, with no notice, no public notice, no notice to the adjoining property owners, in one session of the city council, managed to pass a tentative approval tripling the size of our kennel. This is with no public notice. As that word percolated out, and of course because there was no notice, many of us got together and decided to fight this. And of course, not any of us had the slightest idea about land use laws. We were, first thing, amazed to find that you only have 30 days to appeal this firing the planning commission and all these events that happen, or you lose your right to appeal, and then all you're doing through the LUBA process is trying to state why you missed 30-day deadline. So we filed a LUBA appeal trying to get this thing remanded back to the citizens of the town to get some input at the public meeting. And the original land developer brought in a builder, and to get approval, what the original developer showed was pictures of houses that he was going to build, and these houses were in the $150,000 range. What the individual that he sold the development to, who I'll call the builder here, informed the city council that he was going to build was houses in the $90,000 to $100,000 range. Now, there's nothing very elitist about the small town of Banks. A $90,000 to $100,000 house is more expensive than, at that point, really anything in the town, so it wasn't the more expensive versus the less expensive. But the problem was that the school administrator of the school district had gone to the Beaverton school district and said, okay, if we're going to have 400 houses of $150,000, what does that mean in terms of the demographics of the kids that are coming into the school system? And it meant X number of high school kids, X number of junior high kids, X number of grade school kids. The Bank School District, extremely short of space, working out of 10 modular houses, 10 modular buildings. I wouldn't dignify them with the term houses.
Yeah.
The less expensive houses meant that Bank School System absolutely could not handle the grade school kids that would emanate from those houses, according to the Beaverton School District. And so a letter was written that said the effects of this development on Bank schools would be terrible and irreversible. To step forward in time, with that, many of us went out around the town, talked to the city council, and of course we got 3 minutes at the city council meetings to talk about something that was going to triple the size of the town. Another election was held. The mayor that had approved this whole thing was voted out of office. The city planner was fired. The city engineer was fired. The city attorney was fired. But we were left with an approved, tentative approval on the development with a school district that had no say. They were going out trying to get funding. And a year goes by. We're doing everything we can. We're not really talking about the development. We're talking about getting this thing back to the citizens who can have input on the development and what they want to have. Well, the developer, really nothing we did had any effect. The developer managed to so screw up the application process that his development was disapproved. This is after 18 months of not doing things. And in essence, City Council of Banks decided the developer, Aho Construction, filed for final plat approval late, didn't include the proper materials, and that what it did file was incomplete. Based on its own public hearings, the unanimous vote of its newly appointed planning commission, which also held a public hearing, and the recommendation of a city planner, a city engineer, and its land use attorney, and a city attorney, the city council denied the application. Aho had ignored details like proper sidewalks, parks, access roads, and the impact on the fourth most crowded school district in the state. Aho reapplied, but this time Aho went ahead and filed a lawsuit, $18.8 million, naming myself. I'd like to include my son in that. Many families in the surrounding area of Banks, the mayor, the planning commission, every member of the city council who had voted against them. And when you talked about intimidation, I can tell you we had what public support we had drawn up, I'm talking financial support, was hard to come by in a rural area like Banks. We had people literally send in anonymous letters asking to be taken off the list so that they wouldn't be sued. Of course, we had no idea who they were since the letters were unsigned. I mean, it was awful. And so Aho reapplied, and surprisingly, any of us that were being sued under advice of attorney were advised not to speak. That was pretty effective, and his development sailed through. There wasn't even a murmur of protest. Unfortunately, once you launch a lawsuit, the lawsuit goes on, has a life of its own. It was thrown out of court on the first possible motion for summary dismissal. I and another fellow, really the only two people of the 18 of us that were sued that could actually afford an attorney, paired up and paid an attorney in Portland about $20,000 out of our own pockets to have the suit thrown out of court. And we tried to get our attorney fees back, but as the judge said, to throw the case out of court on summary dismissal means that the judge has to assume that every allegation is true, that I had stood up in a city council meeting and used racial epithets because of the lessening of the price of the houses, had said I don't want any of them people in town, had been opposed to children, which there's days, but you know, the fact is that not any of the allegations were true. No actual charge was leveled, but the suit was extremely successful. And the result of the suit was that the developer was granted the development. I and another guy paid the attorney fees. We were never reimbursed by anybody. The developer quickly sold the development to another developer who is excellent, Wally Rembold. The issue was never the development, was only the lack of due process getting the development in. And Banks had to build a new school. City services have gone up many times over. And so what I'd like to say is when citizen participation is limited, it hurts everybody, and that's exactly the situation that we were trying to fight when we got into this thing, and we wound up having our participation limited in trying to help open the process up. So, you know, I thank you for your time with regards to the amendment which somebody handed to me. I I don't know enough about what you're trying to pass to know whether this is good or bad. But what I would say is don't let this process get bogged down in terms of political infighting. The citizens of Oregon deserve to be able to go into a city council meeting and speak without the fear of being sued. And the gentleman who was sitting in this chair made a wonderful point. It's not just developers against citizens. It's anybody against anybody who simply abuses the law and wants his own dislodge it. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much, all of you. Charlotte Mills here. And we'll take Ellen Twist as well. Ms. Mills, I apologize. I see you came from over 100 miles away, and our policy is to give those people priority, and I didn't, so my apologies.
That's perfectly all right.
Ellen Twist isn't here, okay? Go ahead, you have the forum to yourself now to make up to you.
I'll try to go quickly because mostly I want to endorse. But my name is Charlotte Mills, and I live in the Yahuk area. And I come today to both seriously and with good cheer support this House Bill 2805. In my working life, I've been a public school teacher who taught history, civics, and government. I've been a newspaper editor, and I owned and ran a Northwest book publishing company for 17 years. I'm also a slackee. And that case has been very well covered by my friend Portia Foster. I was one of the Yahas five. By the day we walked into court, we started out being sued for $125,000 a piece. The day we walked into court, it was $450,000 a piece. And as Portia told you, we did get exonerated in that case. But we ended up with almost $40,000 in total legal fees. And we're doing what George Pring from the University of Denver, who coined this term, slap. He teaches a law school in the University of Denver. What he recommends, we're slapping back now. But, of course, that's costing money, too, and it's taking quite a bit of time. And we have hopes that if this bill gets through and things inch along like they're inching along, it might even have an impact on that case. But in the almost 40 years of teaching and publishing, I have never seen a threat to the free press and the free flow of information to the public as we have today. The epidemic of slap suits, beginning pretty much with Love Canal, has grown by leaps and bounds across the country. Never have we needed legislation like this bill as much as we Oregonians need it now. I have some testimony before you. I faxed some of it last night to some of you, and I've added a little bit to it. And the issue that I'm just going to focus on, because I think many facets of the bill have been adequately followed, is that because I have been a member of the small press and championed the small press in this country for almost 35 years, we call ourselves unbought and unbossed versus many, I don't know if you know, but many of the middle-sized newspapers in our state and in the Northwest now are owned by three major syndicates, all in the East Coast and in the Midwest. And I can guarantee you they do have editorial policies about who gets reported on and how gets reported on. And for one thing, you do not cover and you do not insult real estate and development because of they are big advertisers. I don't mean to make that a blanket indictment, but believe me, that's what small independent newspapers are not a party to. Now, I think I've probably royally confused things in that when I made some additions just a few language additions that I would like to suggest the committee look at, because they have to do with newsletter editors, letters to the editor, and news stories from the regular media, which have been talked about and alluded to today, but I fear in the current language does not adequately cover us. And I'll just focus down quickly on why, because our experience in South Lincoln County and in the Yahas area has been this. We've had two different slapses. They've gone to the circuit court. They've gone for summary judgment, and we have, I don't know if they're uninformed judges or just not sympathetic judges, because there was adequate opportunity there for them to look at something that you find on page three of my testimony, and that's the Oregon statutes 30.155 to 30.175 that cover and give the guidelines to the courts on what is defamation, what are the parameters of defamation, what are the responsibilities of the plaintiff to prove by preponderance what is defamation. And it also gives guidelines on corrections and retractions in a timely fashion. Now, that's, we're covered fairly well in that, but I want to say that many of the judges in our state are ignoring these Oregon statutes, and I, you know, wish we had some provision in this bill. I suggested including the press in several places, but mine was based on the proposed amendments that I had from April 26th, not the ones that are dated May the 5th, but I've handed that to it in, and maybe you can take a look at that. I don't want to hold up the possibility of this bill being passed with the current language, but I did want to point it out. I also would like to point out, I've included in this testimony the testimony of Mr. What is his name? Matt Jarvis. Matt Jarvis is our hero and a courageous small-town radio station manager and newspaper. He's a one-man operation. He's been named Man of the Year in Walport two different times because he stays on duty when we're isolated from the rest of the world, when there are mudslides and the power goes off, which happens a lot on the coast. And he was one of the slappies, too. And in his testimony, which I've included in my packet, you will see how Mr. Jarvis was chilled and how he had to modify how he is now reporting stories and who he doesn't report on and issues that he does not report on. And that's the very, very good example of what we people that are concerned about small press and about the newsletter material and about people like Portia, and one of the celebrated cases that no one did get to testify about, and that's the St. Paul case where a woman was, I believe her name was sued for $500,000 because of a letter to the editor. The bill may or may not include these provisions right now. If not, we'll be back in 2 years and try to strengthen the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, next we'll take Dave Hunnicutt and Mitch Rose.
He's with me.
It's like the old days.
I'm not saying Mitch and I are going to agree on it.
That's right. Let's have a little conflict here. People are starting to fall asleep.
Chair Burdick, Dave Hunnicutt, Oregon Internation, speaking in opposition to House Bill 2805 as it's currently written. I think there is an error in the language of the bill, and I'm specifically referring to lines 10, 11, and 12 of page 1 of the bill. As I read the bill, there's no immunity for a statement that's made
that is false and immaterial. So in other words, if I make a statement that I know to be false, but it doesn't have any relevance to the case, then I am subject to a lawsuit. At the same time, if I make a statement that I know to be false, and it's material to the application, then I'm subject to I'm immune from litigation, which I think is exactly the opposite of what was intended. And maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think it's a good public policy to encourage people to make statements that are knowingly false and relevant to an application. If it's not relevant to the application and it's knowingly false, well, you know, no harm, no foul, because presumably the decision maker wouldn't take that into account in any event. And so, you know, no big deal. But at the same time, if the statement is relevant to the application and the person making it knows that it's false, I'm not sure that we should be providing folks immunity from those types of statements. And you know, we've heard a lot of talk about developers, but one of the things that we need to understand is that some developers are folks like the clients that I represent that are, you know, a married couple of 65 who want to build a house in a rural area. Those folks have, in many cases, put their entire life savings into a piece of property. They're the ones that the previous folks have referred to as, or they would fall within the category of developer, as some of the previous speakers have referred to. And for those folks, if they're in the process of a quasi-judicial application, and an opponent to their application comes in and makes materially, or knowingly false testimony that's material to their application, and they lose their application as a result of that knowingly false testimony, the outcome to my folks would be they'd be financially devastated. So there is the shoe falls on the other foot as well, and my folks would not have a remedy for statements that were made that were knowingly false and material to their application. I'm not sure that that's what was intended with this legislation, but that's the way it reads. If it's essentially, you can be untrue as long as it's relevant. But if it's irrelevant, you can't make a knowingly false statement. I don't think that's right. What we would propose, if the committee is intending to move this bill, would be to amend line 11 to take out the word "not." So the immunity conveyed by this section does not apply to any statement of fact that is known to be false at the time the statement is made, and that is material to any issue. So, in other words, as long as you're saying something that's not material to the issue, then you have no immunity. But if you're saying something that is material to the issue and that you know to be false, then the immunity under this section wouldn't apply. Either that, or we would suggest the amendment on lines 5 and 6 of section 1, page 1 of the bill, to eliminate the word quasi-judicial, so that this immunity would apply in an administrative or legislative proceeding, but not in a quasi-judicial proceeding. Because, Senator Burdick, in a quasi-judicial proceeding, you're not talking policy in a quasi-judicial proceeding. You are talking about applying the existing law to a current set of facts. There's no policy argument in a quasi-judicial proceeding. So as opposed to a legislative proceeding like the one we're having now. So the immunity that we enjoy now in this legislative proceeding when we're talking about policy shouldn't apply in a quasi-judicial application where we've got a single person making an application for some type of specific project, and that could be anybody from a big developer to one of my clients. But just understand, and I can't convey this point enough, that my folks who also fall within the definition of developers, stand to lose big time if somebody torpedoes one of their
projects with a knowingly false statement that's material to the case, and we can't do anything about it.
Okay.
Thank you.
We don't have to talk about all of this.
I'll keep my testimony brief, Madam Chair.
Thank you. My appreciation.
For the record, my name is Mitch Rose. I'm a policy development specialist with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And good afternoon, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure whether I should say, and members of the committee, but anyway.
Good afternoon.
I'm speaking today on behalf of the Department of Land Conservation and Development and also the State Citizen Involvement Advisory Committee. And this bill goes back, traces its origins back to those two groups. We heard from people over a year ago that slaps were becoming a problem. We heard from some of the same people that testified in this room today. And they came to us and said, look, there's a state policy issue here that is very significant. On the one hand, the state, through Statewide Planning Goal 1, a number of laws, and certainly in planning and in other areas too, strongly encourages citizens to speak out in public forums. And on the other hand, the state has a system of laws with a very low threshold for civil litigation. And that low threshold enables people to get sued to become the subject of slaps. And there's a conflict here. Because if people can be encouraged to speak out in a public forum on the one hand and then be sued for their time and trouble on the other hand, this clearly seems to be a conflict in state policy. And as a result of those citizens coming to us, we did some research. We held a couple of hearings before CIAC. We contacted a lot of different organizations, and we, at the agency, became convinced that there was a serious problem here. And we drafted a legislative proposal back in July, I believe it was, of last year. It went through various processes, and legislative council went through the governor's office and eventually came out in the form of Senate Bill 330, and it came to your committee. And along the way, Representative Schrader over on the House side introduced House Bill 2805, which was identical to Senate Bill 330. It just added that provision for punitive damages. And we thought that was a good idea, so we jumped on the 2805 bandwagon, and that's where we are today. We think it's an excellent bill. We think it's a badly needed bill, and we strongly urge the committee to send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. I've handed out a packet to all of the committee members that contains four parts. First of all, there's a single sheet of paper that represents my testimony today. There's second, a rather thick packet of buff-colored material, material on buff-colored paper, that is testimony, either written testimony that we have received from various individuals who have been slapped or who are concerned about slaps, or it's summaries of testimony that we've heard in hearings. And there's a second pack of the material in there on green paper, which is editorials from around the state regarding the topic of slaps legislation. And then finally, there's a packet of material on yellow paper that is just news reports and articles about this over the last year. And incidentally, for anybody in the room who's interested in this material, those packets are available in vast quantity in the back of the room, and I had to use a hand truck to haul them over to this committee hearing, so please take some of them. I don't want to have to haul them all back over to the agency. The upshot of all of that material that is before you, I think, can be summarized simply by saying that there is very strong support for this bill. Some 30-plus people and organizations are represented in that buff-colored packet and have spoken out strongly for either House Bill 2805 specifically or at least for some kind of legislation to control slaps. The House Judiciary Committee on Civil Law passed out this bill with a due pass recommendation to the House floor on an 8-1 vote. The Department of Land Conservation and Development, the Land Conservation and Development Commission, the State Citizen Involvement Advisory Committee all support this bill. The Governor of Oregon supports this bill. That's House Bill 2805A engrossed. He supports it in its current form. The House voted 49-9 for this bill.
the major newspapers of the Willamette Valley, including the Oregonian, the Statesman Journal, and the Eugene Register Guard, all have spoken in support of strong anti-SLAPP legislation. And I was going to end up that spiel today by saying that not only is there strong support for the bill, there has been no formal opposition to the bill. But I guess I'm going to have to recommend that remark for two reasons. One is I think I hear Mr. Honeycutt saying that Oregonians in Action opposes the bill. And the second reason is that John Chandler of the Oregon Home Building Industry stopped me in the hall and said that my testimony was inaccurate. He said that it was his recollection that over on the House side, he did testify against the bill in the House hearing. Now, I characterized John a number of ways in a number of hearings, but I hope I've never mischaracterized him. And John, I'm doing your thing here. I want you to listen carefully. I don't want to be guilty of mischaracterizing John Chandler. And if, in fact, he said that he was opposed to the bill over in the House Judiciary Committee, then he knows better what he said than I do, and I'll have to confess that there is a person on the record who does oppose, and now two people on the record who do oppose House Bill 2805. But other than those two exceptions, there's very strong support for this bill. So, again, we urge the committee to send the bill to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. One final point on the subject of Lyme that was raised by Mr. Honeycutt. This came up on the House side, too. What happens if there's a lie in a Planning Commission hearing? Let's say that Mr. Honeycutt's applicants for a permit come in and test and appear before the Planning Commission, and I'm a concerned citizen who's a little loose with the truth, and I stand up and I say, that house they're going to put in there will generate 500 trips a day on the county road, and that's outrageous. It'll cause severe traffic hazards, and therefore the proposal shouldn't be approved. And I know that to be a lie. I know that to be false. Well, what happens? Well, first of all, we have a Planning Commission of seven people up there whose job it is to sort out information like that. Second of all, we have a Planning Commission which provides a public forum in which the applicants presumably can stand up and say, that's false. We have information to indicate that the house that we're proposing in this farm zone would generate 10 trips a day or whatever the appropriate number is. So we already have a forum for sorting these things out. And what I'm hearing from some sources is that the threat of any kind of a lie is so severe that we should push all of these things into a brand new forum. We should take them out of the Planning Commission meeting or the school board meeting or whatever it is. We should send them over to court, and we should litigate them for a couple of years to get to the bottom of it. And that seems grossly out of proportion to me. We already have a forum to deal with truth and credible evidence, and we don't need to chill citizen involvement and to threaten innocent people or to cause innocent people to go through slaps and spend a couple of years defending themselves just because of this hypothetical problem of an occasional lie being told before a public body. So that concludes my testimony.
Thank you. Council has a question.
Council, I think you just answered it, but I just wanted to make sure. And I've drawn several different diagrams on my bill just to make sure I understand exactly when the community conveys when it confers and when it doesn't. But if I read this, am I correct in that one may not be sued, meaning they will be immune for a false yet material statement?
That is correct. They would be immune for a false statement so long as it's immaterial. They would be.
No, as long as it's material.
Right.
They may not be sued if the false statement is material.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think, you know, going back to my law of the press and news training, it's kind of the free marketplace of ideas theory that justified that, where if you're on task on a subject, that if you have everybody participating, that you will eventually get to the truth without any one person having to have total knowledge of the truth. Okay, thanks very much. Next.
The paper that I've just handed you is the current law on immunity for testimony to legislative committees, and you'll see that it's almost the identical wording.
Mm-hmm.
You're immune
unless the statement is knowingly false and immaterial.
Right. Okay, Jenna Ingram and Andrea Bushnell. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. Jenna Ingram representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. All members frequently participate in public forums, particularly in matters of local land use decisions. And we would agree with the statement by Mr. Honeycutt that the bill does appear to be flawed in lines, I believe, 10 through 12. The dash A8 amendments are ours, which represent the New York Times standard for the liability, and we believe it is cleaner language, much clearer language, and would take care of some of the discrepancies that have been brought forward in, as far as interpretation of what the bill does. I wanted to point out that there was a lot of discussion, or a number of witnesses brought up the fact that the vote on the House side was 49-9. At that point, we had not become involved in the bill, and I was just listening to the discussion on the floor of the House because I was interested in another bill, and this one happened to be before it. And the discussion was very interesting to me because a number of people said, yes, we understand the bill is flawed, we understand there's a problem, but it's late in the session, we want to move it out so they can fix it on the Senate side. We believe that the amendments that we have brought forward would help to clarify those discrepancies, and our Vice President of Legal Affairs, Andrew Bushnell, is with me to explain why those amendments are a good idea.
Thank you.
Hi.
Welcome. Thank you, Burdick. For the record, my name is Andrea Bushnell. I'm Vice President of Legal Affairs for the Oregon Association of Realtors. The issues that I want to address today, first of all, I want to mention someone said that they thought that our dash 8 amendments were meant to sabotage the process, and I want to make it very clear that that's not at all what we were trying to do, but rather clarify the issue, and I think in reality would make the bill stronger and not weaken it, and I will try to explain myself as clearly and as quickly as I can this afternoon. First of all, I'd like to address the materiality issue. I think that we all agree that false statements are not immune and should not be immune. But the issue then goes on to say, and that is not material, and I do agree with Mr. Honeycutt that the way I understand what the intention is, but the way the bill is actually written, it says that if a statement is false and it is not material, it's immune. However, I think what everyone means is that it's false and it's material to the issue, that's where you really want to make clear that that's not okay. No one wants, I don't think, in this room would want someone to be able to falsely testify in any jurisdiction on a material fact. And so I think that actually it's written just backwards, and I would agree with Mr. Honeycutt on that. I understand that on the House side there was a lot of conversation about whether they should change the standard from false and material to false or material. And clearly, if you change it to false or material, you would cure the problem of whether you could have a false material statement be immune. But what it wouldn't do is really eliminate the slap suit, because anyone who wanted to bring a slap suit, of course, would just say that they were bringing a slap suit on the immaterial part of the testimony, which I don't think is anyone's intent as well. So what we have proposed, and do propose today, is that you simply eliminate the materiality portion of it. And the reason, I actually think that materiality is a red herring in this. The goal is of this legislation is to keep immune speech that's made in good faith and that's truthful. And I don't think materiality really has anything to do with that. And so what we have proposed today is actually the New York Times standard, where simply immunity conveyed by deception does not apply to any statement of fact that is known to be false at the time the statement is made, or that is made with reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of the statement. Of course, that is the part that is the New York Times standard. I did understand legislative counsel to come in very early on in the day and testify, and in his testimony he was talking about language that should not be immune would be
testimony that someone knew or should have known to be false. And the should have known to be false that he testified was part of this, it is not written into the legislation as it appears today. And that's really all we're trying to do, is add the should have known to be false by adding the reckless disregard for the truth or falsity of the same. So we are not trying to torpedo this. We're not trying to sabotage the bill. We simply want to make it very clear. As an attorney, I would look at the way it is written right now and say, I know that I would personally, but I could see another attorney interpreting it and saying, great, we can go in, we can tell all the falsehoods that we want, as long as it's material, and we can't, and we'll be immune under discussion. I'm sure that's not what anyone meant. So,
thank you very much. We have one more.
There you go.
We have one more witness who signed up, Richard Engstrom.
Good afternoon. My name is Chris Angstrom. I'm the Managing Director for the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I have not tracked this bill until today, and I have to say that I agree that the two knots in this particular sentence become pretty troublesome. So I'm in agreement with both Dave Honeycutt and the last two speakers. And the suggestions of either taking out the knot or taking out the whole phrase on materiality would seem to be appropriate. One can see that if on a quasi-judicial proceeding, which is how our applications go through for sand and gravel, where people were allowed to come in and give knowingly false statements that were material, and they come out in great numbers, which is typically the way an aggregate siting operation goes, that the operator would be in a pretty bad position of being able to stand up and say, well, that's not right, and then there's all those neighbors up there basically saying the opposite. And because of that, there needs to be some deterrent value, at least for folks, and it may be through the civil process that we can or we presently enjoy if someone is false and it is material, and they know that there could be action against them. So either one of those fixes is appropriate. I think this is just a drafting error that came out of legislative council. I can't believe they meant for this to apply to false material statements in a quasi-judicial proceeding. So that concludes my testimony.
Oh, okay, thank you. I might just clarify that that wordage comes out of existing ORS that gives immunity to people like you, so if you misstated anything, you are now immune.
Good.
So that those exact words are taken from the ORS. It is not a typo. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, one more witness. Got to be... Go ahead.
Yes,
very quick.
Okay. Oregon Community for Voice and Annexation. Up to today, I was not aware that the aggregate folks, the Association of Oregon Realtors, the Oregonians in Action, and the OBIA were going to officially throw their hat into the ring in opposition. But I do find it interesting that the aggregate industry, the real estate industry, the building industry, the folks that have been suing everybody and misusing the court systems feel that they need to fight this legislation that would keep free and open debate flowing. So I think the only issue, really, is the bigger issue. And the bigger issue is... the city councils, the school boards, the DEQ, whatever the body is, it is their job to sort out the facts from the truth, to put standards where people have to quantify and qualify if their opinion is going to meet a legal standard is unreasonable. Frankly, I'm disappointed that we've taken this turn, but I guess this is really what the essence of all this testimony is about. It's up to you and this body to decide if the testimony that you've heard and the record that's been established is malicious people, defaming people, slandering people, or whether they're being sued for their opinion on industry-driven related issues, public policy issues. And that's my close.
Thank you very much. With that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2805 and adjourn the subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee.